Hope you don't mind it going a little distance there.
No, that's good. But you know what'll be funny is the podcast started with you going, Welcome to the Cognitive Rampage. I'm your host, Adam Lowry, and we are affiliated and powered by Onnit, a total human optimization, supplementation, foods, fitness, education, training, everything better in your life website. Go to adamlowry.com or cognitiverampage.com, click on the Onnit logo. That'll help support the Cognitive Rampage as well as take you to Onnit.com. Onnit.com is amazing. I talk about it all the time, obviously. We open up with Onnit promotions just about on every podcast. But actually, on this one, I have gotten a lot of questions about Alpha Brain, which is something that I take before every podcast, something I take before speeches that I give. I thoroughly enjoy the benefits of Alpha Brain. I really do. It is a neurotropic, okay? And a neurotropic, in lay terms, if you will, is a cognitive enhancer or a cognitive optimizing nutrient, right? And it's a dietary supplement. It can help support most brain functions. So it really helps your memory, your mental speed, and your focus. Now, it's natural, which is what I like the most about it. It's not some synthetic compound comprised in some laboratory like some limitless pill, right? That's not how it's worked. This is all earth-grown nutrients, used. It's thoroughly researched, all right? Earth-grown nutrients, amino acids, vitamins, B6, and clinically, it's demonstrated in 2 double-blind peer-reviewed trials the ability to improve all of those areas I was talking about before, memory, cognition, thinking, etc. So really look into the Alpha Brain. A lot of times if you find yourself drinking a lot of coffee throughout the day, which necessarily isn't bad for you, but if you're also finding a different way to just find a way to fine tune how you think, maybe enhance how you think a little bit or even focus it in more so, maybe so it's not so scattered, etc. But I use Alpha Brain for that. Definitely suggest it. There's tons of other products that on it. That's just the supplement side. But on the food side as well, I order the Warrior Bar, which is my favorite snack of my entire day. Each day that I eat one, it's a old Native American recipe of buffalo meat with no antibiotics, etc., and some cranberries and some pepper. I really like it. It's the best. It's the best. It's very kind of jerky like, if you will. So a lot of times it's hard to really tell what the Warrior Bar is like or what it is. It granola? Is it what? You're not sure. So the meat and cranberries that it takes the form of what you may more associate with a kind of a jerky. But I love the Warrior Bar, the earth grown nutrients. Again, I talk about that all the time. That's a shake that I do every day. Too many ingredients to rattle off to you now, but go to Onnit through clicking on the logo on adamlowry.com or cognitiverampage.com. It'll also save you money as well, plus help support this podcast. My guest and back on the Cognitive Rampage is Glenn Marshall. Now, he was on the podcast a couple weeks ago, and it's rather early to be bringing somebody back, but I love talking to him. I love talking to Glenn Marshall, his passion for the change that he's on. He was on the show a couple weeks ago talking about a drug policy convention that he was headed to, and now he returns with news from that drug policy convention. Now, this drug policy is important to you as well, because it encompasses all angles of drug policy, whether it's treatment and rehabs or approaches that people take down to certain laws that allow certain prescribing or drugs to even exist. So it's a impactful conference. So he took a shot, went up there, and was really getting involved. And come to find out, it sparked another passion in him as he returned back to Hawaii under this new guise of what he's trying to put together. And I love it. I support it. But we talk about the policies that were discussed at this convention, who was there, who was not there, kind of the water cooler talk, if you will, of this political convention. But I loved it, as always. I love talking to my friend, Glenn Marshall.
Yeah, well, sometimes it's like that. Everybody out there knows that feeling. You know, we try to get these things technically dialed in. We want everyone to have a good experience out there. So, you know, that's a good sound to start with.
You know what's new about this podcast for me, man?
What's that?
I went the whole podcast with you last time, and all I got to stare at was your cute little mug on your podcast artwork.
You don't know what I went through to try to get a internet connection over there. If I would have done better with a couple of styrofoam cups and a big string going to Florida compared to trying to get that LTE booster. And then, that was from my cousin's house, and she didn't have any kind of video or whatever. But, yeah, this is me. What's up? Nice to meet you, man.
It's good to actually see you, man, and look at my boy.
Right on. To him. Right on. Florida genetics.
So what's been up with you, man? What have you been up to couple weeks?
Well, yeah, it's funny. I figured you were going to ask that. I've been on that mission, right? So I did the Washington, D.C. thing. I lobbied my senators.
Okay.
Oh, man, face-to-face. That's the first thing I want to say on this podcast is if anyone ever feels like they want to make change out there, you know, accessing your senators and your congresspeople and things like that, it's not hard to do, man. They're just kind of sitting in there, and you can make an appointment and go on in. And even if you don't get them, you may get a high-level staffer. And if you can connect with the right ideas and things that are consistent with, you know, maybe directions they're going, they'll hear you. So that was the, you know, one thing I really wanted to put out here is all that idea of lobbying and things like that. You can do it too. No question about it, that if you want access to, not to say that they're going to, you know, hey, this is exactly what we're going to do, but there's something about relationships and rapport, and sticking your face in front of someone else's face is a powerful thing. So you can do that. And I did that. And
how long did it take you? I mean, a lot of people don't know, right? That's what they all tell you, right? Your senator, see your Congress. I mean, what's it take?
Yeah. Oh, well, so here was the experience, right? So this all was involved with that International Drug Policy Conference, which turned out to be the largest conference of its kind ever. The first day of that was Federal Lobby Day. I had signed up, I guess, about 2 months earlier. We were supposed to have about a team of four or five going in there. This is what makes it so cool, man. So
it's before you get going, update people on what this convention and policy is, because a lot of people listening have no clue what you're even doing.
Okay, so here's my world, right? So my world is like lonely therapist, just kind of doing a, you know, working with families, working with kids, intensive home base, multi-systemic therapy. And I get this bug in my mind about, I guess it's been about 4 months now since I started the Addictive Podcast, to start pulling my head out of the sand and actually maybe even expressing some of the beliefs I have about that I don't like my patients going to jail. I don't like their charges following them their whole life for addiction. I don't like that my patients are dying because they can't get clean diacetyl morphine or whatever other drug they want. I don't want to pay for people in prison who have addiction problems. I don't want to pay the people who are making money from the people, you know, in prison, all of it. So I get sort of fired up around that issue, and I picked up a Bluetooth headset and started doing the Addictive Podcast. And I was just started expressing this stuff. And so this conference was, there's a group called Drug Policy Alliance, and what Drug Policy Alliance does is they are sort of the hub of, and from being at this conference, it's different from what I thought. So there are actually quite a few groups that were at this conference, and to name a few, because they're critical to understanding this whole thing. So at this conference, again, 70 plus countries, 1,500 attendees, you had These are the ones that stood out to me. Number one, and I'll even if you want me to get into these, but Students for Sensible Drug Policy. This is a group that has hundreds of chapters around the country and now quite a few, I think, around the world. This is the most hot shit organization, man. These guys are all the student voices, not coming from like, hey, I'm a been there, done that, and this is the way it should be with addiction. Not coming from sort of this purely medical standpoint. They are coming from a sort of community-based, university-based, sort of policy front. And not only that, but advocacy. So they have a huge contingent there, I should say. Then you had Families for Sensible Drug Policy, sort of the family version of that. Really focused on the families, focusing on getting good information. And a lot of the stuff, by the way, here's what's crazy, man. A lot of the things that we've talked about addiction and treatment and harm reduction and all that, these guys are fully on board. And that was one of the real weaknesses of this conference. But Families for Sensible Drug Policy, harm reduction psychotherapy, Center for Optimal Living, all these guys are about whatever it takes to help people, in or outside the scope of prohibition, which is, I guess probably the biggest generator why everybody's there. You had MAPS, right? You had multidisciplinary something, psychedelic studies. You had all those guys there. I'm interviewing the Ibogaine guys next week from the International Ibogaine Alliance. I have no idea about this shit, right? I'm like, well, go do your steps, man. I don't know about Ibogaine and all that stuff.
Ibogaine's amazing, brother. It's actually showing to cure alcoholism. And I say cure, not treat.
Oh, I know, right? So I keep hearing all these things. And so you have this rallying of all these different groups. Now, when you want to do advocacy or things like that, I would say one of the best things you could do is get to a conference because of some, whatever it is. If you're like, man, save the manatees, you got to get to a manatee conference because that's where everybody kind of rallies around that has the connections to what you want to be doing. So I went from like lowly, 43 now year old. It was cool. I did this lobby day on my fucking birthday. It was the shit, right? So, dude, I went from like lowly, like, solo therapist to like intricately connected with Students for Sensible Drug Policy, Families for Sensible Drug Policy. Dude, I'm fucking back here in Hawaii. I'm now connecting with University of Hawaii faculty to possibly develop Students for Sensible Drug Policy here. I'm going to build a fucking army. This is part of my plan. I'm going to build this fucking army and we're going to go talk sensible drug policies, ideally in secondary schools and communities, and start at least having an informal conversation about drugs, about harm reduction, all that shit. I didn't know that, if you're an amphetamine user, that actually getting to bed before or making your last dose prior to 3 p.m. is like an amazing harm reduction technique and you can sleep. I didn't know that. Yeah. Well, this was actually a recent podcast I did actually with another guy. I didn't know that forcing yourself to eat prior to your first dose of amphetamines as well. Again, this was focused actually on Ritalin addiction, all this, but speed in general. So even these harm reduction techniques around methamphetamine, just being open to different ideas, policy. I can't wait to have the conversation. So I'm trying to fucking follow through is, I guess, the moral of this story, not just talk it, but fucking walk it. So be it.
You're gathering some. I really like that student organization you're talking about. Well, I mean, are they what they're trying to do really? What is have a general open conversation about drugs themselves, kind of like Dr. Carl Hart is trying to do.
So imagine a group that's made up of, just picture this, right? And they're coming out of the university, so they're like a new voice, right? Picture this. Picture a group that has neuroscience students on it, that has medical students, that has nursing students, that has public policy students, that has criminal justice students. And now, see, this is what I'm trying to actually use them for my own ulterior motives, because what I want to do is I want to turn, like, they right now they do this great, they can do speaking and be a part of things and talk policy and all that.
I think they're the fucking voice of the future. And I think that them getting into more advocacy and having that, dude, what's a more natural connection than science-based education coming out of the universities into the communities regarding drugs? Why are the fucking cops the deliverer of the info on high about, you know, how to deal with that shit, except for the fact that's all they've been doing? Right.
So why shouldn't that be a doctor or a trained drug professional educating the children? Not a threatened, because it's not fearful.
Right. Remember,
it's got to be a cop with a big scary guy who's going, hey, listen, just abstinence is the key.
Yep.
Just say no to sex and drugs and that's it, or else.
Dude, and that's what was so amazing about this group is these guys who were there, they weren't like, I mean, dude, and you picture like these aren't like some stoner group, man, whether they use or not. I mean, it's clearly not prevalent in their lives. These are like academic. This is the top tier of these schools. And they function like that, and they present like that, and they were on panels like that. Dude, rock solid. I mean, this is the type of group you want representing drugs and drug use and showing, especially as you start delineating between use and abuse and adolescence and things like that. You want a bunch of kids from the best universities being like, yeah, on occasion I smoke weed and on occasion I drink, and here's how I mitigate the fucking harms when I'm out when around a bunch of people binge drinking, and here's how I deal with, you know, sort of whatever issues I have. But they are very functional in sort of their, I would say, whatever their use is. And again, it's funny that as much as you would think use would come up at a place like this, it never really comes up. You know, I guess everybody sort of has, I mean, everybody there was just entirely functional and entirely driven, and that was the priority.
Everybody seemed to take what the empirical academia approach to changing policy. Dude,
I think everybody's desperate. You had a lot of like, vocal New York there, who's like, I think big harm reduction organization there. Dance Safe was there, and they're doing all the testing and stuff like that on recreational chemicals at dancing. So all these people together, and then sharing ideas and that whole thing. But
are they trying to change actual policy? Were they attacking certain policies in effect, or just bringing awareness?
So, dude, so here's my angle, right? So everybody, or at least a lot of people in there, are all about the marijuana. Like, for example, Federal Lobby Day, it's all about weed and stuff like that. I picked two bills. One was, and these are ones that Drug Policy Alliance is pushing. So one bill was reducing sentencing, the other bill for rescheduling of marijuana, but I fucking angled that shit, right? So instead of just going like, yo, go weed, whatever, I took the approach of what we need in Hawaii. Well, I'll say this in Hawaii. So Hawaii has a really serious methamphetamine problem. You have cartels trying to undercut the fucking heroin market, just squeezing meth in there. So you actually start seeing a lot of the former opiate addicts getting on meth. Dude, the approach I took, and I knew this is what the representatives would hear more, is instead of just going rah, rah, weed, I found two studies, one study out of Japan, one study out of Italy. The study out of Japan talked about methamphetamine as a neuroprotectant against methamphetamine toxicity, which is fucking amazing, right? Wow, who knew weed was like this thing, right? That actually prevented, like, inhibited brain damage to some degree if you're a meth smoker. And number two, another study that talked about cannabis as a relapse prevention agent for methamphetamine. Right. And of course, oh my God, Senator Hirono, what a genius, right? What a scientific mind, I should say. The first thing she mentions is, well, have these been reproduced? Perfect. Which is such a brilliant response to anybody. Sure. I mean, especially a politician, like looking at science. I mean, for them to say that, whether it's in my favor or not, like, great job. And my point was, they can't be reproduced here because it's Schedule One. Let's make it Schedule Two, i.e., this is what I'm sort of pushing for. So, The idea of approaching... So
it sounds like, though, she knew to ask that question, because, look, those senators aren't stupid. They don't ask a question unless they know the response.
No.
She asked that question to get the response out there that, look, we can't get the test for it. I mean, you see now, I mean, for me, it's a daily use for ADHD medication. And there is tons of duplicated research out there that does point to marijuana be a very effective replacement for Vyvanse and Adderall.
Well, her next comment was all about, well, how about talking to her aide was, and this is what is so cool about actually being in front of these guys. Her next comment to her aide was, well, let's call the Surgeon General.
Which was okay. Like, go her. Like, all right.
All right. Yeah, fucking whatever. But speed dial that shit. You know, I was just like, well, obviously this is the right place, but so getting all these groups together, imagine that they're different positions, they're different angles. And really looking at combining that is to one solid movement going forward. And that's, so being at the conference is allowing me to draw on those organizations and sort of create what I think Hawaii needs in regard to, well, actually drug education reform is primary prevention is what I'm really looking at now.
Well, let me ask you, I'm going to use a therapy technique on you, brother. If you went to sleep tonight and you woke up tomorrow and a miracle happened.
First of all, this feels so good, man, because I don't go to therapy. And I find myself relaxing the second you even ask that. So go on. I'm sleeping. All right, what's happening next?
So if you go to sleep and you sleep well tonight and a miracle mm-hmm. happens and you wake up tomorrow, what will the miracle have been?
The miracle would be that families have good information and honest information about drugs as best as it can be. And they know about how to mitigate the harms as best they can under whatever framework they're in. That there's good information out there and that they're making judgments based on science. That would be that's it. Just let them know, man. Let these families know. Let them know the truth. Let them make decisions. Let these college kids get a hold of them and start showing them that this fucking drug war caused more harms to their loved ones than probably any drug ever could, except for booze. But, you know.
Yeah, and while we're on that, man, that's perfect segue, brother, to exactly what I wanted to talk second about to you. And it kind of hopefully it links to the policy some or the Drug Policy Alliance somehow.
Sure.
A lot of people don't know. You talk about education of what to do, you know. And so what I'd like to kind of walk through are what are the options, let's say, even in Hawaii, and we'll compare it to over in Florida even. Let's say somebody, you know, does have a problem with synthetic prescription drugs or even narcotics. And, you know, the big one now is painkillers, but let's call it some other drug, whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, the drug's not the enemy, but let's just say it's consumed them for the time being. Mm-hmm. Now, their first step would be to where?
It totally depends on the individual. I mean, that's really what you're looking at. I mean,
the options, right? What can the option do now? Obviously financial determines a lot, right? So
sure.
Just walk through the options. What are the available options to that person at that time?
In Hawaii, it's kind of a difficult question. I mean, it depends. So we're talking an adult, for example, not an adolescent.
Right.
Okay. So if you're an adult and the scenario is that you are having a problem with drug X or something like that.
Correct.
Huh. Well, you know, the most logical one would be, let's see, what would be, it's, you know, it's funny talking about that because it almost makes me feel like.
And you know what, I'll go ahead and qualify it for better diagnosis. Sure. It's full on biopsychosocial effects. So you got, you know, moderate to severe use.
We have sociological consequences. I mean, potentially probation involved or whatever, or I mean, what's usually going to happen, right? I mean, especially if you're in the criminal justice system is you're going to be,
you know what, you know, I want to leave that part out because, you know, we all know the criminal justice system fucks people. So to leave that part out, let's take the regular person that has you know, maybe had a surgery, was not informed, and has found themselves, you know, 6 months to a year later on pain pills.
Yeah. So if we're talking about pain pills, first of all, you get a lot, I would say not a lot, but you have some more options, right? So you have, first of all, the first person to talk to in that situation is your, oh God, and please, I dread, you know, the shitty doctors. Well, no, I mean, the best path there would be talking to your primary care physician. And
All right. All right.
Yeah. Okay. Where are you leading me here?
All right. Hold on. No, I didn't mean, you know, I totally forgot about this. I had a lengthy discussion the other night. My wife being an ARMP.
Okay.
I said something just kind of quickly and kind of upset that I said, you know, literally it doesn't make sense. But what I spouted out is that when a doctor or a practice family care physician prescribes antidepressants, that he is practicing beyond his scope of practice.
Mm.
Now, yeah. I know it's a huge statement, but
dude, I don't think it's that huge at all. I mean, most, I mean, how much training do MDs have in behavioral health? I mean, I totally agree. The most I'm hoping for is like, well, they're going to make a referral to someone who prescribes Suboxone, or they're going to somehow have access to Naltrexone. The first thing is to get some fucking preventative measures in there and some safety measures. So the first thing I'm looking at is Naloxone spray or having that fucking that thing you hit yourself in the leg with that could shoot you up with Naloxone or Naltrexone or whatever the hell. So that's the first thing I'm doing if you're an opiate addict.
So it's consult your physician. Now a lot of people don't have physicians. Right. So they don't have insurance, so they can't do that, or they just go to some clinic and they talk to a doctor, and this doctor then spends 5 minutes with them maybe.
Right.
And then proceeds to go out of his scope of practice. And let's just say the person is maybe, I don't know, just feeling depressed. All right. And sure. Maybe not full on, addicted yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the doctor reaches right to the antidepressants after 5 minutes with someone, hands them the antidepressants and sends them on the way. Or maybe after the surgery, hands them one of the most addictive properties on the planet.
I thought he was going to reach for a notepad to write down another address you could go to is actually what I thought you were going to say.
All right. Right. So,
like later.
Right. So they hand them these pills, whether it's pain pills or antidepressants, both can be dangerous in their own right.
Right.
With no education, no pre-counseling. Now, what some doctors have began to do is they make you to go, you go to get a psychological evaluation first. So they come see like someone like me, and I got to see him twice for an hour. Now, after I see him twice for an hour, the doctor's already made his diagnosis anyway. Now they'll come back and he'll give him the antidepressants if it was depression, anxiety, or
does he refer to your agency as well that did the assessment, or are we not even going there?
Right. He just, it's almost like he goes, hey, I had him evaled before I gave him pills.
Right. Okay.
And then it's kind of like, man, so, all right. So back to the person who may be depressed or maybe addicted, they have to seek out a doctor. So this is where it all starts, right? So it's to the doctor.
Right. In a perfect world. I mean, what's a perfect world? So a perfect world. And I can honestly say,
no. I don't want to talk about like what should be. I kind of want to walk what our options are currently.
Well, in Hawaii, okay, so this is what would happen, right? So if you're my patient, right, or and I'm sort of a doctor or whatever, so I would be looking at finding because I know these fucking people, right? I would be looking at finding a really good addictionologist or which is an MD that is qualified under American Society of Addiction Medicine who really knows his shit. I would really be trying to find a medical professional who can sort of be the overarching person in whatever treatment I'm getting. And in for two reasons. Number one, I want someone who knows how to fucking prescribe medicine and does it like my boy over here, who's like an alchemist, dude. It ain't about labels or names for him, man. He's like, okay, I'm seeing a little tinge of excitation. So we're going to, round that off with a little GABA. We're going to, take a little, we're seeing some serotonergic issues here. We're going to pump that up with a little, SSRI, just a dash. I mean, he treats so precisely, I would say, by doing that. Now he's not an addictionologist. He's just a child and an adolescent psychiatrist, but because then you get in, I guess the addictionologist can be sort of, a little bit sometimes zealots, but generally that's what I would be looking for. I would be trying to find a really good medical professional that understands addiction and doesn't fucking freak out if you have one
Or I'm going to say doesn't reach for the prescription pad right away either.
No, I mean, that's not helpful either. I mean, again, you talked about that comprehensive evaluation. Ideally, you have a really good relationship between that assessor and that doctor. And that doctor would actually really be hearing and collaborating with the assessor. That's why I love the new, integrative care model in the primary care setting, essentially, right? Which is getting your behavioral practitioners in with your doctors, is because those guys can really fucking feed off each other, right? So, if I'm working in a doctor's office, like I used to sort of in the methadone clinic, you had clinical director, all that, medical director, having access to them and them hearing me and also me hearing them and having that collaborative relationship, that's critical. So I would be hoping, oh, dude, here's who you fucking talk to. Here's who you talk to. You call the Center for Optimal Living in New York City, Andrew Tatarsky, harm reduction fucking psychotherapist, or Barry Lesson, who is another harm reduction doctor. Remember these names, Barry Lesson and Andrew Tatarsky. You fucking call those guys and you tell them Glenn sent you, and they will hopefully guide you to the best in care, because those guys were the two premier harm reduction psychotherapists that will deal with you honestly and in a balanced way and won't judge you for anything. Now, again, I'm sure they're booked for a million miles out and they're fucking expensive. But
that's what I want to go back to, man.
It's hard finding good people. I mean, who the hell do you find? Truthfully, it's not easy.
Right. So that's what I'm trying to say is people act like the health is out there, that the help is out there. And so right now, as far as we've gotten, is somebody needs to seek out a professional that they generally can't afford. They're 10 to 20 grand for a program. You know, I do a program myself, which is the Cognitive Rampage program, which is in my book about changing your life. But
you do that on an outpatient basis kind of a thing, outpatient more?
Right.
You don't have to go into necessarily like a facility. Like, it's really going to depend on the assessment and things like that. I mean, I would, you know, tend to don't freak out if you're really averse to even inpatient. You know, I try to seek out some more flexible, you know, therapists that understand addiction, but can also dedicate sort of the time that's needed to sort of refocus and rebuild life and do those sorts of things.
Yeah. And, you know, to stay on kind of what people really know, too, because it's what they're sold. You know, shows like Intervention do a lot of education to people and families about how they're supposed to handle a family member that is suffering from addiction. So right now, all they really know to do based on commercials is to either, you know, surround them and hold and tote them off to some inpatient rehab. And if it's Medicare funded, we already know what's coming with that kind of treatment.
Yeah.
And if it's a private treatment, what are we talking? 15 grand to 80 grand?
I got a better one for you then. Then what you're wanting to do, okay, this is kind of cool. We get in all the like real treatment shit. And I always want to talk about this. I keep talking about fucking drugs, man. Honestly, I care way more about like addiction and shit like that is way more interesting to me in terms of like process and healing rather than drugs. But dude, you're going to look up, if you're out there and you're hearing this and you need help, you're going to look, and especially a family, I'm going to send you two places. Look up Craft, C-R-A-F-T, Interventions, okay, which is this sort of, again, a systemic kind of intervention, not based on the twist your arm or, you know, and break it if it doesn't
We're all here today because we want to first read to you how much we hate you and how much you've ruined our lives. And now after this, we're going to tell you it's because we love you. And the only option for us to keep loving you is if you get the fuck away from us right now.
Dude,
that's an intervention, brother.
For some people, I believe that to some people, throwing a bunch of fucking alligators in a room with them and saying, you better run through that door or else the car is outside. I believe that is the only, you know, I truly, fucking addiction can be a bitch, right? I mean, you really got to sometimes find certain things. But again, Craft Intervention, a much more holistic sort of, you know, stages of change. I think you can generate change. What Craft Intervention is essentially, it is an intervention. It is a motivational type process. But it doesn't depend on fracturing your relationship with the person. And that's actually was kind of a key theme in a lot of this. And again, I'm all for fucking, well, contingency. If you do this, you know, whatever. But if you don't, you know, then this happens. But really maintaining, especially with teenagers and things like that, the relationship between the parent and the child through, you know, whether it be experimentation or even into problematic drug use, maintaining that open conversation, being able to fucking talk. You know, people always blame addicts and they're like, oh, they're fucking liars. Well, dude, they're people. First of all, they're not inherently like, drugs don't make you lie. What makes you lie is the circumstances that you're in and you needing to fucking find a path through that. That's the least shitty that you can find. And generally that involves bullshit because we're living in a fucking world where to talk about drugs is fucking to doom yourself. I mean, it is, whether it be addictive or casual use. I mean, something slips out around the wrong person and, oh, well, there goes that fucking promotion, right? You're not getting that.
I mean, you speak to the bullshit. Look, some companies would call it a successful marketing idea by making money on bullshit. I mean, the word natural itself is the epitome of that. So somebody that's suffering from addiction is going through life, and you're right, they get attacked. So we're back to the person who maybe knows to go see their doctor, who now gets hit up with antidepressants. Now, let's say they, I mean, they have no insurance. Most people are not insured in this country.
Yeah. Well, and so don't you think the doctor's going to send him the treatment? I mean, I'm not saying, I'm just picturing isn't he going to be like, well, you got to go to a fucking program, or is it going to be a little bit more sensitive and a little bit more client centered in your experience? I find that a lot of them are going to error and just be like, you need treatment. I'm scared. I don't want to lose my license. It's that kind of a moment.
Well, most of the family physicians are going to refer you to a psychiatrist. They're going to let the psychiatrist take the evil out, because they're going to let the psychiatrist risk the substance addiction or whatever diagnosis. Right. And that this is the person that also is generally going to diagnose you with bipolar or something else. Right. And look, the frequency that I see of the diagnosis bipolar is fucking unreal. And look, it's a real
up there, hasn't it? I noticed that as well. Yeah.
I kind of want to say, look, if all the people I've seen in just, I don't know, the 2-3 years of practice that I've been that have been diagnosed as bipolar, I think we have like the whole population of the state of Florida in like 2 hospitals.
Yeah, it will, you know, and especially bipolar. I mean, try to tease that out from an active addiction, dude. I mean, that is not the easiest thing to fucking do either. I mean, active addiction looks like bipolar by any means, even if there's no bipolar. So it's,
So the person is now back talking to a doctor. Now, let's say they do refer him to a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist then now makes another diagnosis. Let's say maybe you had 2 counseling or assessment sessions between there. This has all cost you, I don't know what, a couple $100 so far?
Did I have to pay cash for the evaluation?
Yeah.
I'm saying I could probably get in the doc for copay there. Yeah, I'm probably into the, put me below $500. Maybe I took off a day of work there to get in for the assessment.
All right, cool. So now we've lost money because we lost our fucking job. Right. Now the psychiatrist, he needs clientele now. So he goes with a bipolar or a, you know, major depressive disorder diagnosis of some kind. Maybe he, you know, some trauma appears in counseling and hits you with PTSD and ADHD too. Mm-hmm. Now you get hit with these 3 or 4 major diagnoses, and now these become what you're fighting, and the drug addiction is a symptom.
Right. Now,
this is so far, not one person has really talked to you about the 4 essence that I think that really create a addiction, which is behavioral, environmental, the routine, biological, and the cognitive.
Yeah.
You know, and so right now, no one's talked to you about drugs. You've talked to your doctor. The doctor went, well, shit. Well, if you're feeling depressed, try taking these antidepressants. No, doc, I'm having an issue with pain pills. All right, well, go see the psychiatrist. The psychiatrist says, yeah, it's because you got these mental health diagnoses. That's why you're doing that. So take this concoction or cocktail of 3 or 4 pills because you're bipolar or whatnot. Let me know how this works out for you. Why? Oh, were you on pain pills? All right, let's try Suboxone too. Now let's treat these 4 medications to treat your bipolar, these as a maintenance drug to make sure you don't die. Okay, these are fine. I mean, that's the route, brother.
You know, it's funny. It makes me think of how like even look at like a lot of the organizations, NIDA, whatever, you know, or not even NIDA. Actually, I was just thinking of the CDC as they try to tease out, you know, pain management from addiction, from dependence. Like this is, you know, one might actually say that the safest thing they were doing was medicating themselves on fucking opiates throughout that whole process, and maybe the 4 medicines they're on now. I mean, truthfully, right? I mean, opiates have been used for fucking depression remedy, like from the beginning of fucking time, apparently. So, you know, people are treating themselves or making themselves feel good. And yeah, now they're sort of off of that and on these. And well, I guess you get to see your therapist once a week or some shit. I don't know, man. That's fucking, and addiction is so so invasive and comprehensive. It seems so insufficient. It does seem so insufficient when we talk about treatment like that. So then what's our alternative? Going to the IOP program? Now you're doing the IOP and you're in there and everybody else is mandated, but you're like sort of...
You know what my answer is? Honestly, I think it starts preventatively. I think before doctors hand out narcotics of any kind. Mm-hmm. I think what has to happen is more than 2 days of counseling. I think it needs to be pre-counseling medically by the doctor about addiction, counseling support about it, informed about what to expect from these pills. And you don't get handed 90. You know what I'm saying? You don't hand them I do. 90 and you pre-counsel because then I think, like you said, right, families that are educated and know. So if somebody knows what, you know, is to be expected, look, you're going to take this pill, you're going to want to take it more and more, you know, whatever. I'm fast forwarding.
You know, a lot of that sort of lends support to this idea of this integrative model, right? Of having the therapist right in the fucking doctor's office. Bro, generally, doctors don't know shit.
No, see now when I made the statement that a doctor that prescribed antidepressants, I'm being general, but a family practitioner that prescribes antidepressants is working out of their scope of practice. I said it again.
No, that's funny. I mean, you're entirely true. I are entirely accurate. I remember when you know, psychiatrists were pushing to get prescribing prescribing privilege on the, and actually that would almost make more fucking sense because at least those guys would be comprehensively trained on the use of antidepressants and shit like that. You know, it wouldn't be a crash course. The only thing they know less about addiction is like, you know, well, I guess now they know more about like preventative health and like, you know, fucking not eating a shit ton of carbs and, you know, now eating vegetables. I mean, you know, doctors would immediately go for symptomology versus any kind of fucking preventative care, prior. So yeah, dude, I totally get your point. I mean, the doctors really don't know shit. I mean, one of the ways I'm even able to promote myself as a therapist is by sort of, I know the right guys to talk to, you know, because I happen to have fucking friends that I work with that seem pretty capable. But just kind of going out there and going to your PC. Well, the biggest concern right away when I think about opiates, first of all, I'm hoping the doctor's prescribing, knows about this shit. But my biggest concern is that you're immediately going to get kicked off your fucking opiates, right? Because that's the rule, and essentially you're addicted and whatever. And now here's the big changes, right? Now CDC is really Center for Disease Control. Actually, they made a big fucking mess of things recently. But there's a big push for exit planning now on opiates. Right. Exit planning. That if you have someone who's addicted to opiates, that you are going to be looking at either a step down plan or transition, maintenance therapy, either Suboxone or methadone, some sort of exit plan. You know, the fucking cartel's going to be real bummed about this because like we were saying last time, you couldn't have designed it better. You just boot them off. And then these fuckers over here become the big dealers. By the way, you know, actually, it's funny. You know, I was reading the thing yesterday. The cartels had actually predicted that. They had predicted the big kickoff. I always wonder if they just go to the ONDCP parties and like, yeah, fight the war on drugs. Those guys are like, come to Papa, right? Yeah. So,
I would agree. Yes, man.
No, I mean, you were talking about that sort of that whole systemic approach, and God knows, I mean, they must have fucking people doing the accounting and evaluating the, you know, future prospects.
My question, if they're going to create a policy that's an exit strategy, from coming on, why can't we do an entrance strategy of kind of going, look, before we hand you these very, very highly addictive things for your hips? Yes. There's some other things that you can do. You know, here's a diet plan. Here's a rehabilitation, icing and heat. And, you know, here's a multitude. Now, look, those pain pills do help, but if necessary. But if someone is pre-counseled, they got to be, I don't know, maybe if we can control how they're distributed, you know, they're given out by the hundreds.
This is such a huge problem. And see, I'm even taking it a step further, right? That's why I'm going after this idea of primary prevention in terms of getting all these fucking brilliant college kids into not only the community, but secondary schools to kind of empower this information. Like, so even in this model, I think I'm not trying to formalize this. I want a fucking totally informal conversation to take place in secondary schools. Dude, why aren't we talking about fucking opiates? Why is even the information, you know, I appreciate that the doctor should be doing that. And of course they don't have the fucking time, or they're going to refer off to the counselor who's in there with them, whatever, hopefully. But dude, these conversations about drugs, I want to fucking start happening on a very casual basis in schools, honestly. Oh yeah, my parents are on fucking oxys and they're maintaining it. I want all this conversations out in the open, just being honest. So people who are potentially going to be struggling or potentially facing shit or whatever, at least, you know, I'm hoping they have the knowledge even before they get to the doctor, because I mean, it's true, man. The doctor doesn't have much time, or it's like, go do this, and they're rushing you out.
Yeah,
and
I don't want to demonize the doctor either when I'm saying that, because you said it. They're getting pushed from a, you know, insurance side, from a, you know, if they belong to a group or a hospital, they got quotas to hit, you know.
Well,
so
they just don't know, dude. They don't have most doctors don't have the fucking time to deal with addiction. The addiction people are a pain in the ass. I mean, they're yeah. fucking a risk. They're you know, what is it, something like 80% of the resources go to the fucking fewest number of patients when you're talking about a practice.
And the ERs are backed into corners because, look, they can't withhold help. And so if somebody's coming in needing treatment, well, what you end up getting are ERs that'll pass out, you know, three or four, you know, little hitters, you know, so they
is
can
that
bounce.
How that works?
Yeah, so they can go to an ER and, you know, get the one or two shots. Now, a lot of the ERs are starting to get on the same program, same computer system, but still, you know, they do. They hop now. I want to go all the way back, dude, because I'm going to get tangential. So we're still back to the really your only option when your friend or your relative or spouse or yourself is, you know, all of a sudden you find yourself can't put down the pills and missing work. And so your only choice is to see the doctor who now originally probably gave you those pills. You got to go back to the same guy who gave you the pills.
Well, dude, that's so, again, I don't mind if he gave me the pills. I just hope he understands sort of the transition in and out of these things. I don't know. I've never been to a chronic pain guy. But I'm sure, I mean, even for myself working in addictions, dude, addictions and chronic pain. I remember working at the methadone clinic, man. You know, I'm in pain. You know, you have your levels of withdrawal, you have your physiological pain, you have your fucking health pain from being so constipated and shit like that.
You're right on. They go hand in hand.
By the way, one other treatment I would say to our imaginary buddy here is there's that new once a month naloxone. That can be for some. Now, of course, people like to get fucking high, dude. And
I don't know about the naloxone.
Well, dude. Okay. So you have. I think it, now there's naltrexone. Naltrexone is actually IV, I think, but naloxone. So there's a lot. Naloxone is a opiate antagonist, right? So what you do is when you take naloxone, it can reverse withdrawal, all that shit. They have an oral spray for it now. They have one that you punch it in your fucking leg and it'll reverse your overdose. But the new one, dude, is this once a month naloxone shot that is essentially and is a antagonist. So it's blocking opiates. So you try to get high, you don't really fucking get high. You can try to override it. You don't really get too much. I would imagine it can cause some anhedonia as well because you're fucking blocking your, you know, opiate receptors to some degree, whatever. But dude, you don't get high off fucking opiates. Now, again, you may certainly transition like I want to get high off of something. So I'm trying this or trying that. But that's another new treatment, expensive treatment. But dude, getting a shot once a month where you can't get fucking high, that's an interesting alternative too. So just throwing that out there again. And the opiates are simple. Look at all our maintenance therapies.
All right, naloxone, Narcan.
Bring the same conversation we're having, and it's a methamphetamine addict, and we have a totally different fucking set of options. Go tell your doctor you're smoking meth and see what kind of, like, you know, casual regimen you get, or if he doesn't just freak out, call the nurse and you know, scurry you off to some facility. I'm not sure, but you know, there too,
so,
right?
So it's got some severe symptoms too, you know, related to opiate withdrawal, you know, increased heart rate, agitation, restlessness, nausea, vomiting, sweating. So you would administer small doses. So you're doing micro doses to ease up on the withdrawal symptoms, just like you said.
Of which, the amphetamine stuff or the opiate stuff you're talking
about? The opiate, an opiate overdose.
Oh, well, opiate overdose, you're shooting them up with naloxone or not shooting them up or using this. Yeah. And you're immediately getting, I mean, it's immediate, dude. You hit someone with fucking naloxone who's an opiate withdrawal. You're going to, not opiate withdrawal, but an opiate overdose. And they're going to flip over to opiate withdrawal just about a fucking moment. So you are going to be like, what? And they're going to get instantly sick. It's kind of crazy.
You know, there's a lot of, and these things are great, man. They really are that can help people that are really, you know, tragically there. But, you know, if we're dealing with the person that looks to say, look, they haven't quite lost their job yet, right? Their spouse is looking for help.
Functional use. Yeah, absolutely.
No, I don't even really mean functional. I'm going to say they're 8 months and they're 2 months away from losing everything. Their wife, their job, the house.
You know what I mean? Okay. So they're spending money. They're already hitting kind of the streets. They're already getting the fucking, you know, pulling some drugs off the streets. Yeah, smoking heroin once in a while, dude, when the pills run out, you know.
Right.
All right. The whole fucking gambit. Yeah, they're so
again there's. All right. Yeah. So again, they're stuck to go to the doctor. I mean, that's really where you start. And if you're close to ODing, it's really check yourself into a rehab, right? That's how it goes.
Dude, you could do the rehab. I mean, I would look at, so whenever you look at any treatment, right, you want to find the least invasive therapy. The least invasive therapy is probably like one of these outpatient therapies, Suboxone, probably methadone. It would be for perfect engagement on a heroin addict, you give him fucking heroin. You start him on heroin and you make sure at all costs that he's not buying street heroin. He's not getting fucking AIDS. He's not getting Hep B. He's not getting robbed, shot. Or doing those things to get the drug. That would be the first point of any kind of engagement in this perfect world.
Now, heroin, you know, maintenance isn't necessarily necessary for withdrawal at all either, right? I mean,
No. I'm looking at this purely as a prevent further harms from the black market. Get them a clean source of fucking drugs. Vital. And then of course you can go towards tapering or wherever you want to go, but safety first, man. Same as methadone. When you start dosing methadone, you want to dose aggressively. You want to get them up to a dose where they are not using street heroin. And a lot of people who do take methadone will use fucking heroin, and they'll use heroin because, dude, they still want to get high. Getting high feels good. Getting high is a moment in good life, you know, all that shit.
Cheaper.
I mean, and especially sometimes, I mean, you might even want to say less side effects in regards to that versus a bunch of fucking psychotropics, man. You know, probably numbing out on some opiates or opioids
that's interesting, bro. Glenn, I'd like to see that study, man, is because true. I argue a lot of times that antidepressants and other narcs can be equally as bad. So, I mean, concoctions from lithium and Zoloft and, you know, Namenda, mix those three drugs to treat something like bipolar. What does that do as opposed to just maybe, you know, withdrawing from opiates directly?
Yeah. Well, I mean, SSRIs have their own discontinuation thing, discontinue, you know, all that. Well, dude, all medicines, right? All drug effects have different effects, and some people respond beautifully to certain ones, and some people really struggle. And if you're really struggling, you know, I mean, you can be up the creek, because if the legal ones are the ones that are the ones you really don't work well for you. And like my buddy over here, who's a fucking three-tour vet, and he smokes cannabis to manage his PTSD and hates those fucking meds. Well, he's kind of shit out of luck. Except for, I think, Veterans Day, they fucking passed a thing where he can do that now. But I told you, I tried Adderall once before for ADD, and I can focus and study, but it made my face feel like it was like cold and, I don't like a drug effect like that. I don't like to feel always medicated. I just don't like that feeling.
Yeah. On a sick note about Adderall, man, back when I was slanging back way back in the day when I was selling drugs, when Adderall began to hit the market, I was in college going to school. I won't name the college, but I was going to school and I was, you know, selling a little bit here and there. And then this Adderall drug showed up. And all of these college kids were crushing it and snorting it up at these parties. And so I got a fucked up idea where I ended up with like 500 or so. And I crushed them all up and made up little powder. And I went around selling blue powder, and I was calling it college cocaine. I mean, it was that prevalent in school.
You sound like as good of a marketer as any of those other fucking people who are doing that shit. I mean,
they market it. Look, I was just a drug dealer, right? Yeah, I didn't have the research and marketing campaign working for me.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, I still see people that, you know, are on Medicare and Medicaid at a private practice. And I can't tell you how many people that I'm seeing oh, I was diagnosed with ADHD and all these things, you know, young ages and stuff like that. And you go, wow, man, that early, you know, it's that prevalent. I remember, I can remember when it hit college and I was like, wow.
Dude, you got to hear this podcast. I just did a podcast, Addicted to Adderall, man. You got to hear that fucking guy. 8 years, he's functional on Adderall, functional to the point where it's almost became sort of dysfunctional. But what a fascinating ride that guy had on that drug, four amphetamine salts combined.
It's amazing, right? It does. Hey, your house will be clean.
Oh, yeah. Well, dude, amphetamines are performance enhancers. Make no mistake. And aside from the fact that you don't really feel like you need to eat, which results in certain little physiological problems, and you don't really feel like you need to sleep, which results in certain physiological problems. I mean, other than that, the shit is apparently, not to mention the fucking number of adulterants they put in methamphetamine and all this other crap, or it's all gross, all the fucking nasty drugs, man. Well, I've never been a speed guy, tried coke. What did that do? Made me feel like I was strong or something for about 10 minutes. I'm too fucking what is that, like, I was gonna make a Jewish joke, but like, I'm too fucking stingy on that shit to be spending my fucking money on those types of drugs, dude.
Well, dude, I would tell you that I'd say 8 out of 10 times, you know, it's gonna be pain pills, it's gonna be direct pain narcotics. That's what people are really being affected by. I would tell you the blue collar person, that is who's being affected by it, because look, the average diet of the blue collar person is horrible. The average exercise is horrible. So their body's going through shit. So they tend to have a little bit of insurance. So they're the first ones at the doctors that start treating, what is it, fibromyalgia. Yeah. And, you know, so they start popping pills to try to fight pain. Now, I get the pain, look, if you're not eating what you're supposed to, working out like you should, then you're not really doing all you can do.
It's not easy, man. I mean,
agreed. I don't want to take away from how hard. No,
I had the fucking access. I mean, like, dude, like, I have access to the ocean here. I had access to the fucking infrared sauna, right? I mean, dude, fucking, we probably get out to cryotherapy if we wanted. Like, fucking Joe Rogan's all into that shit. dude, we drink. Dude, I spent all that money on fucking kale and beets and all that crap. That girl died.
You said a girl died in New York or Ohio?
Oh, yeah. A Hawaii girl fucking died in that thing. Yeah, she was a local girl, man, and she died in that fucking chamber.
What the fuck? Hawaii. Yeah, sorry, I said New York.
Yeah, yeah. Well, she was over in, I think, Vegas or something like that, but she was from here. But yeah, man, so we have access to all that shit, but I totally can see that. I mean, you know, someone's busting ass fucking construction, dude. All they have is fucking pills to feel better. Beyond that, all they have is maybe dope to feel better.
And that's, you know, that's the connection I'll make is, you know, that person A can't take off work, you know, to go treat addiction, even though what every therapist and doctor is going to tell you, look, you need to take care of that right now. But, you know, they may have kids and families. They can't like just stop working. You know what I mean? Yeah. Much less do they have 18 or 20 or 25 grand or 60 grand to throw at these really, really unique treatment facilities.
Yeah. How the fuck you check out for a few months and go to rehab?
So here's my thought is, I know a lot of people, even myself included back then, that talked about, you know, how they got overcame addiction, et cetera, or have so far, or may refer to themselves as recovered or sober. Mm-hmm. You know, they talk about, some people have referred to, they needed that extraction. They needed that 30 days, 60 days to be away. And now I started thinking, you know, then they assume, you know, relapse comes with recovery. Now, I wonder how much of it is because you're in a protected environment, everything's okay. And then all of a sudden you return back to that same environment, really, because you have to. That's where your kids are. That's where your wife is. That's where your job is. And, oh, fuck, relapse again.
Of course.
What if we could put the resources towards someone that really incorporates the change behaviorally, cognitively, biologically within the person's existing environment, meaning they go to work and a coach goes with them or something, right? And so a life organizer, a time organizer.
Dude, welcome to my world. That's exactly what I do. That's exactly the model of therapy I do. That is multisystemic therapy. That is intensive home base. It is that exact exact model. Now, I guess in one sense, it's not as efficient as running everyone into a group. But what you were describing is exactly the most effective way to fucking treat people that I have seen for addiction right there. So, I mean, you're exactly right, man. I mean, that's why residential gets such shit from sort of, you know, from payers and shit, is because sure, you can house someone for a while, but the second you march them right back into their environment, all those same fucking cues, you know, a person knows how to function and they light back up now. And dude, that's the whole, what are you doing over there, dude? I could see this guy jumping on his buddy.
I have to tell you, man, did you see me fidget around like a motherfucker?
No, I see your
head. I'm still not out of the woods yet. All right. Yesterday was leg day. Okay. And I beat the shit out of my legs. And then this morning,
are you stretching?
No. Hold on. Then this morning I spent the morning mowing the yard outside and all. So I'm sitting there talking to you. And my fucking hamstring, dude, it fucking jolted. And I couldn't get comfortable. That's why I was moving around, dude. And I got to stand the fuck up. I'm not out of the woods yet, brother.
Dude, I've been having problems with that, man. I fucking popped my second rib, dude, right? So I fucking popped up one rib in jiu-jitsu, dude. So I'm out for like a couple months. Bruh, I go back one day, and I figure, like, dude, I like rolling with the girls, right? Because the girls are all fucking technique, and they don't that necessarily break my old ass bones, man. So I wind up rolling with this one girl, friend of mine. Fuck, bro. I go for triangle and fucking bam, exactly the other side, same fucking rib on the left, pop, rib on the right now. I mean, dude, the first roll of getting back after fucking getting injured in jiu-jitsu, the other one blasts, fucking pops. Dude, I talked to somebody, they said it's because they're aligned, whatever, but so I'm just waiting for those to fucking seal themselves up in a little armor, and I got a whole fucking, dude, so I've been out of jiu-jitsu, boss, and my ass getting all bony again. Dude, I swim like a fucking squid, just dragging my legs in the water, man, all that shit. So yeah, I can relate.
You're spending too much time in the policy office, man. Getting back, dude, into saltwater.
I was doing in Virginia, I was all fucking doing like even doing like squats and elliptical, but I don't usually do that shit, man, because of fucking jiu-jitsu for a while. But so now, dude, I've been out for like, I feel like it's been like 4 months, and now it's like hard to get fucking back, man. I'm like, oh no,
dude. That's why I've been down in water. I brought three waters back here with me when we started the podcast, and I downed all three of them since and it still didn't help. I still cramped up before.
Well, you need salts too, right? You got to have some salts in there.
Yeah, I'm a salt freak, man. I think I fall asleep with sunflower seeds in my mouth sometimes.
Oh, no, that's good, dude. Well, fucking do the Himalayan pink salts and all that shit.
Oh, that's on the counter, man. My wife filmed me the other day. She doesn't tell me now. When my Onnit box get here, she says I act like a kid. So yeah, when my Onnit box shows up, I'm like, all right, I'm in. And so I start opening it up like it's fucking Christmas. So she popped the video camera on.
Dude, here's a fucking health tip for everybody out there. I don't know about like how everybody sort of works, but I'm telling you this, dude, as long as I down one of my fucking crazy shakes, I put one down before every meal. Like I was doing one every other meal, but dude, one of those kale, beets, celery, ginger, cucumber, fucking couple mixed fruit, pineapple.
The Hulk.
Yeah, dude, I do one of those before every meal, and I'm able to fucking regulate my eating. Then I'm usually just eating proteins and oils, or I don't really eat bread or pasta. But dude, one of those before every fucking meal is like the key to health in my world. Like, I mean, honestly, those things saved my life. Those fucking kale shakes, dude. So, yeah.
Oh man. Now, before we were in, you know, it's that same fucking hamstring, man. That hamstring as well put me out of football, everything. It's been,
that sucks.
It even put me out of this podcast, dude. And so back to
patient. It's all right. We can wander, man. We can talk about all sorts of shit on here. It's good. We get time.
Oh man. Fuck. Back to patient Joe. So
patient Joe
can't leave work, right? He can't do. That's kind of what I'm saying is I don't want to be the person that avoids saying, well, thank God there's something, right? I get that. I get the thank God there's something. I get that. Thank God there's rehabs, even if there's 30 days or whatnot. Mm-hmm. But well, the something that there is could be so much better with almost no money, barely any changes, you know, and just a different approach, really.
Dude, it's funny. I was looking at this and I think that multi-systemic or intensive home base, if you wanted to do the full nine, like if you wanted my fucking total services, look like me as a therapist, I, three clients, I would say max, right? About three clients, up to even like 80 hours a fucking month, something hardcore like that. Something like, what's that?
You hear that? Look, if it sounds like I'm in Baghdad or some shit like that, there's fireworks going off like right next to my house. Like,
Is that Disney shit?
No, the little community I live in, it's very fucking Pleasantville. It's kind of creepy, but
it's nice, dude.
Yeah, it is. It's cute.
We get fireworks over here. It's nice, man. I like it.
It's cute. All right. And so there tonight was good. Yeah, it was awesome. And so it's just we all mow our yards at the same time. It's weird. It's creepy weird, man. So the fireworks are going off, man. So it's
just... no, you can't even hear it. But yeah, so I mean, picture that model, right? So I'm thinking this whole model would be about $5,600 a month. Insurance would totally hook up the provider. It could even be the provider working with the doctor in the integrative setting, or they refer out like myself. And we have, and we go marching in there and we're just fucking in that person's life and setting up social supports, maybe even shepherding them in a 12 step if that's what they want to be doing, shepherding them into smart meetings, smart recovery meetings, if that's what they want to be doing.
Who's paying for that? How are they getting your services?
It would be insurance. Insurance would be paying. And again, this is the perfect dream model. My model is funded by the state, but in the perfect dream model, it's paid for by insurance and insurance would be more than willing to pay $5,000 as opposed to, fucking.
Private insurance? Are you talking this is state insurance, government, Medicare? What are you talking?
Well, for this level of service right now in Hawaii, this and actually it's in a number of other places, North Carolina, and I think I think Minnesota just got it. Multisystemic therapy is a program where it's state funded, right? So money is coming through whatever channels into the state. The Department of Education is referring. Back to the Department of Health and saying, yo, man, this kid's a real challenge. What are we going to do? Or even more than that. Oh, this kid's on probation, has multiple factors influencing his life, problems at home, problems wherever. And so they'll send me in for a total life rebuilding, 4 days a week. In certain cases, I'm with the family one day. I'm tuning up the kid another day. I'm looking at community supports another day.
How long is a program with you like that?
6 months. Usually about 6 months, can run longer or shorter, but super intensive for 6 months. So by the time I'm gone, there is hope stabilization has occurred. An effective treating physician is in place. Family has contingencies and behavioral systems all in place, reward systems, functional systems of good, healthy transactional patterns, all that shit. School has strong, a full, FBA, functional behavioral assessment and behavioral support plan in place. They're working with the parents. Everybody feels like, okay, this kid, we got the corral built and sure he can bounce against the walls of the corral, but he's not breaking out.
Is great. Why doesn't every state run this kind of program?
Well, I would imagine it's because it's, here in Hawaii, the idea was it was the old fashioned way. Well, we can send them to residential and then they come right back and go into the same fucking environment all over again. Or right. We can try to restructure the environment so we're not spending so much. It was simply a fiscal decision of, well, we can save money if these kids don't go to residential.
What kind of success rate are you guys looking at? What kind of program?
I know we fucking blow away all the other drug treatment fucking people, dude, because we're, in terms of, you could look up the numbers here. I'm not really up on all that shit, but in terms of preventing or stabilization over residential care, I think we even do better than that. Particularly in terms of long-term outcomes. So you get out of residential, it's like, all right, go to meetings and outpatient. We definitely do better than that. And also we can be used flexibly, right? So we can even be on the tail end. So if you need a period of stabilization in residential, and then they'll set us up to start working with the family, maybe 3-4 weeks ahead of time, kid comes out, family's restructured, or at least, functioning differently. All those pieces are already set up for the transition. That shit works great, dude. You know, beat them to the punch, beat them to the fucking crisis, you know, have it all ready like that. So yeah, I mean, that's what it's called. Look, yeah. Multisystemic therapy or intensive home-based therapy. If you have kids out there and your state offers that or something like that, pay attention. Now you can have a fucking shitty MST therapist, dude. You can get some of these guys because it can be even a flat salary or things like that. You can get MST therapists, home-based therapists. You're like, yeah, I'll see you once a week and whatever. Dude, we're an intensive service. It should feel intensive. I should be, you know, in your fucking life on every level, to make those changes. Yeah, I get pissed if my patients aren't getting better. I'm like, I fucking dig in on those kids, you know, and their systems to get it. There really isn't much, you know, things can be so out of control where you can't achieve stabilization, whatever, but, more often than not, if you're doing your job with that fucking program, you can get, you're in there, man. You're all over them. So,
yeah. Yeah, I was trying to look it up for people. It looks like I found FloridaKidCare.org.
Yeah.
Kids ought to be covered. The state of Florida offers health insurance for children from birth through age 18, even if one or both parents are working. So for those of you in Florida, which is a shit ton of my listeners, and a lot of them have kids for sure, go to FloridaKidCare.org. And it looks like a real good way to guide you into that kind of coverage.
Well, so what that would be is, so if you're, and now I would say if you're like a parent out there, like the ones you just spoke to, you would probably want to talk to their, like who's ever managing their, like the student services coordinator in the school, or whoever manages like IEPs or 504 plans or whatever. They're going to typically have access to either state care coordination or directly to these agencies that are providing MST or intensive home base. Florida may have it. Wouldn't surprise me if they did, man. It's a pretty well-known program out of, I think, University of Carolina or whatever.
You're just like you said here, it says our partner agencies, where the state agencies, health insurance programs has four partner agencies, where it's the Agency for Healthcare Administration, Department of Children and Families, eligibility programs, Department of Health administers the Children Medical Services, CMS, and Florida Healthy Kids Corporation.
Yeah. I guess in general for treatment, try to get someone who's going to treat holistically. Like we originally were talking about, like a good doctor or a psychiatrist, try to get someone who's going to look at the entire person. It's really easy in terms of drug treatment. Now, again, you might have addiction issues that are so fucking problematic. You can't even get near the person because they're sleeping all day and prostituting all night and fucking healthcare is going to shit and they're in and out of the hospital and mental health issues are, you know, there can be all sorts of fucking crisis like that. But ideally you're getting a provider that can be, you know, stabilizing, holistic, doesn't freak out on addiction, understands that, you know, stability is the priority, safety is the priority. So
different practitioners can work differently. I mean, you might get someone who they really need to, you know, be in the whole addiction thing and they're doing that and doing meetings and whatever, and that's their thing.
But I would really want to know medically what I'm facing with my patient. I mean, that's critical too, man. You can have, all sorts of fucking imbalances and stuff. Infections, all sorts of issues that come with addiction that can be way more severe in presenting than the addiction themselves. So, it's very easy to just kind of look at the drug as solving all your problems, but ideally you get someone really solid in there who kind of has a better idea of how to fucking deal with a person versus, just their condition of addiction. So.
Yeah, I think that's a huge point when you're talking about addiction, man, is getting away from the need of a pill versus and treating the person and from the psychosocial standpoint, not just the direct biological standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, you know, pills. I mean, you know, pills are kind of like they're sort of like throwing a chemical or throwing oil on an engine and hoping it drips it in the right spots. I was watching, I think it was The House I Live In. You told me about that movie. Great movie, by the way. But yeah, just sort of looking at the brain as sort of this bag of chemicals, and you're sort of applying this versus a specific effect. Yeah, I mean, sometimes a med wash even at the beginning is, you know, getting off of everything and where things are at and what are we seeing and all that stuff. Dude, whatever is going to take person A from being less close to death and, you know, closer to health, I'll put them on whatever. I'll fucking, you know, whatever they, that's where I am, man. I'm where, whatever is going to save that patient for another day and where I can try to get to them another day. I'll take that.
Yeah. I think you're right, man. And that's how I feel with what's offered. You know, a lot of times I talk about what is poorly offered, like detox, 30 days, et cetera. And I don't, like I said before, I don't want to sound like I'm putting down, at least there's something, but I mean, there's so much more that can be offered that can do so much more.
Yeah. Well, and ideally, I mean, perfect world, man, you know, I just remember as we do like one of those bring, bring, bring and take, we go back to 1910 and we're, you know, hey, McDean, what are you doing? Oh, I got the old H in my arm again. And da, 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 and we're all fucking heroined up. Well, go down to Dr. Whatever and get yourself some clean heroin. So you don't got to buy that street schmack and he'll fucking, you know, and this is how addiction was. I mean, it was dealt with as this purely medical condition. People weren't going broke from it. The vast majority of people had money who were into addiction because, you know, you get it from fucking Bayer Pharmaceutical or Roche Pharmaceutical. You know, it was a kinder, gentler world to addiction, man. It wasn't always like the fucking, oh, I'm using heroin and the sky is falling. It was like, oh, I'm using the heroin. I'll go down the drugstore and get me more heroin so I'm not sick. I mean, what would you rather see? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I think we say that, but you know, I think if you took I bet 8 out of 10 Americans, you know, your regular blue collar type, if you took them and grab one of their family members and said, look, your family member is going through addiction right now. Mm-hmm. What do you do? And I think, I swear to God, I bet they'd say call an intervention.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, right? People are, I was kind of talking.
But maybe that's the thing, though. I mean, but properly done, like you said, though. I like work. I love that factor, man, that they can really bring this in with you guys and the program you were doing out there.
Dude, well, you know, it's funny when you're working MST, a lot of the times you have probationary involvement. And so you're trying to meet probationary requirements and if the person's using or not. A lot of times with kids, you'll get, you know, occasional marijuana use and we try not to freak out about fucking occasional marijuana use. I just wrote a tweet yesterday, man. If you know, looking at all this sort of replacement therapy stuff they're talking about with cannabis, dude, if you have someone on opiates and you get them fucking like smoking pot and like they give up opiates, oh my God, dude, you're like the greatest interventionist ever.
I would agree, man. And I think there's even research out there. You talked about early on the podcast, the articles or research you brought up at that convention, at the drug policy convention, about how marijuana is effective in, you know, prevention of some things. And, you know, a lot of it speaks, I think there's even a lot of research speaks to, you know, chronic marijuana use and smoking can actually prevent alcoholism and, you know, cravings to drink.
Yeah. I mean, people like, you look at patterns of drug use, people like having a fucking release or not everybody, of course. I mean, a lot of people who don't use and whatever. But you know, people like, you know, having a drink. I mean, they like, you know, end of the day, they have a drink, you know, or on occasion they have a smoke or, you know, that does seem to be pretty fucking normal, man. Not really so strange that people sort of find a drug that they want to ingest to sort of relax from the day. You know, it seems pretty normal. So if we can normalize around that and make that not so terrible, you know,
look, I did find something in 2009, a study performed by the Laboratory for Psychopathology and Disease for Central Nervous System Organization found that injections of THC, the primary active chemical in cannabis, helped eliminate dependence on opiates such as morphine and heroin in testing.
Yeah. And it's funny. I was even looking at in terms of the maintenance thing. And my buddy, Seth was like, he's like, dude, not even for maintenance. How about just for dealing with the withdrawal? Like if you're fucking coming off of opiates, according to that thing you're reading, well, dude, you should be smoking pot. I mean, that's straight up what it fucking says right there. I mean, essentially, so
it goes further. Another study published by the Harm Reduction Journal found that respondents use cannabis to curb their alcohol cravings as an alternative to previous use of prescription drugs to curb cravings, and even as a substitute for more potent drugs such as cocaine. Yeah. And tellingly, 57.4% of respondents chose to use cannabis because it provided better symptom management than all other drugs such as alcohol, opiates, and cocaine.
Right. Not to mention protecting your brain from methamphetamine toxicity and relapse as well for that drug, too. So, yeah, it really seems, man, out of all the, you know, out of all the drugs that could have sort of taken hold or whatever, you know, well, tobacco with the fucking cancer. Well, of course, cannabis, right, inhibits cancer and shit like that. That really does seem to be like the global one that would be like the least fucked up society, you know, drug. I mean, if that was sort of the norm, I mean, God knows DUIs and all that shit would be even all right. Lower, you know.
Dude, everything we talked about, even our first podcast together, bro. I mean, yeah. Another publication, once I get into it, man, I start reading. So the National Institute on Drug Abuse and Addiction, up to half of the individuals who began addiction treatment inside relapse and detox programs relapsed within 6 months.
And
most states move to legalize marijuana, it's become easier for scientists, doctors, and researchers to the point of benefits of marijuana as a treatment for pain relief, including mental and psychological symptom management and for many diseases such as chronic pain and fibromyalgia.
Yeah. So again, looking at, and again, what a perfect drug for, as we talk about harm reduction, right? And again, in my world, abstinence is not a requirement for fucking health, dude.
Oh, Glenn.
Yeah.
While we're on it, we're talking about marijuana. Remember the last podcast, Cut It Off, your miracle cure for the 5% of people, the 5% of people that do experience marijuana withdrawal.
Well, I wouldn't even say 5%. You know, it's funny bringing that up because, you know, when I'm at the Drug Policy Alliance conference, I kind of get the feeling that everybody sort of, you know, weed isn't a big deal. And I'm over there like, I got the cure for craving. And they're like, well, why don't you take that somewhere else? We don't, you know, and they do want to hear it. It's now, you know, again, talking about that conference, man, I got a professor out of Dartmouth I was referred to who can probably help me formalize that shit. Should be really good there too. Okay, so cannabis craving cure. That's so funny talking about weed, the non-addictive great drug weed, and this is where everybody on the podcast is, it's not addictive, da 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 da, right? Well, okay, so here, this is all allegedly, right? This is what has been heard on the streets of I've heard this on the streets of Hawaii, but if it works for you too, all right, the first thing you need to do on any kind of thing like this is you have to get your doctor you have to get your doctor to approve these doses, because clearly these doses of this anti-inflammatory that I'm going to talk to exceed the over-the-counter recommended dose. And of course, we want to make sure that you're under good, you know, medical provider's care. And Cognitive Rampage will have a waiver on that you will, you know, sign through. And once that happens, then you can consider this in.
Here's our waiver. All information on today's show is brought to you by Glenn Marshall.
Right. I know. Totally. Well, here's the deal. All right. So one of the things, and this is what got cut off on the first podcast, and I actually did a podcast on the Addictive Podcast about this. So here's the deal. So if you look at if you look at cannabis withdrawal, and I have a number of patients that it's funny, it's probably the most common drug that folks are struggling with, and not for any necessarily, you know, physiological or issues or, you know, but I'll tell you, when it comes to probations and drug courts, being a cannabis smoker is really problematic, dude.
Yeah. And profitable for the state.
Well, you know, for all those reasons, it's helpful if I can help my patients reduce their cannabis use. So a lot of the kids I work with, are full on. Oh, and by the way, this is my sample size has been expanded. I had
call it what it is. A lot of people got issues. If legal, definitely, but it becomes a cost effective issue too, because sure, the prescription pills can be $5 or $6 and even $1,000 a month. But you know, weed itself, if you're smoking it consistently, and even if you're dosing it out and you're maybe more severe on a spectrum,
yeah,
it's still $600, $1,000 a month.
Well, dude, if you and I'll tell you, this has only been used by the guys. I had one person who didn't really have sort of this, like I would say, this level of smoking. But most of the people I'm talking about that this qualifies for are people who are ingesting cannabis literally from the time they wake up. You know, these were like the majority of these people, except for now two adults, was pre going to school. They're smoking in fucking school. They're smoking when they get home. They're smoking when they go out. They're smoking in the night evening, and then they smoke right before they go to bed, and then they wake up and do it all over again. Okay, so we're talking about someone who's exposing themselves to cannabis almost continuously, right? And so what we see in those types of patients,
is there anything wrong with that though?
No, dude, I'm not. And that's what's so funny is, you know, you peel prohibition out of a lot of this shit. I was even talking to a National Institute of Drug Abuse neuroscientist at the conference saying, does addiction have any protective effects? Like, actually, is there something?
Good question.
Oh, I know it was. And I talked to one of the harm reduction people, and they're like, that's a fucking very interesting way to look at it. And I was even wondering, like, you know, how the body goes into shock, right? Body goes into shock. Well, maybe, you know, we talk about rat park versus the shitty rat cage. Maybe the brain even locks in as some sort of continuous rewarding pattern. And maybe that provides some sort of protective mechanism from your own shitty experience or whatever. And again, I'm not saying this is right, but to get out of addiction is a fucking bad thing, and start looking at all of these patterns as beneficial or not beneficial to the organism and all that stuff. So
I like that, by the way.
Oh, you gotta look. I mean, at least look. I mean, let's explore. Let's get out of the prohibitionary mindset on all this shit, right? I mean, they're just chemicals. They're not the fucking devil. Like let's
right. Yeah.
So right. Okay. So with the weed thing. So if your doctor, of course, approves this, you can tell them that you had heard of this treatment. And I have personally witnessed this now work on, I guess it's about 6 or 7 people. And that is a complete, no minimization here, a complete resolution of any kind of discomfort or craving or withdrawal experience from cannabis. So the feeling of wanting to call your dealer, the feeling of wanting to hit the fucking pipe, the feeling of wanting to do a bong hit, the feeling of wanting to, you know, anytime, even when you're thinking about it or jonesing about it or any of that shit, this has shown total resolution on that. And the regimen of this is, right, and hopefully there, and we were talking about this last time, Adam, and we were so stoked because hopefully there's somebody out there who's like, holy fuck, I got to go for a drug test, or holy fuck, cannabis has been a problem in my life, I really need to quit, or oh fuck, this is whatever the problem is. Having flexibility and control over the transition on and off drugs safely and based on your own willpower, especially if addiction is set in, is fucking valuable. So
yes,
here's the scoop, right?
Fucking sir.
So talk to your doctor and clear this fact. But essentially what it is you're looking at 600 milligrams to 800 milligrams, never exceeding. And now here's, I've seen two things online about this. I've seen one that talks about 3 grams or 3000 milligrams being getting into toxicity from ibuprofen. I also see other things talking about 2400 milligrams and not exceeding that. This is where people need to talk to their doctors. We are talking about prescription doses here. But getting back to why this happens, if you know, looking at the cannabis withdrawal experience, right, you're talking difficulty eating, right, kind of appetite goes away, difficulty sleeping.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. It's presenting. Cool. You're talking about difficulty in terms of thermal regulation, or people feeling warm in terms of sleeping or sweating when they're sleeping. You look at all these symptoms, and what it looked like to me is it looked like a fucking low grade opiate withdrawal, right? It looked fluey. Now, if you look at fluey, you, and then you kind of look at sort of the modern research on that, you think about inflammation and the body, you know, becoming inflamed and sort of, you know, producing whatever it needs to produce to expel whatever, you know, substance or bacteria or virus or whatever that it's fucking dealing with. So I looked at, well, what causes inflammation? COX-2. Actually, I was originally thinking COX-1 and COX-2, but apparently COX-2 is related to the withdrawal experiences talked to me by my psychiatrist buddy. So walking that back, I was like, okay, well, what inhibits COX-2? Well, anti-inflammatories inhibits COX-2. And this is where everybody out there will probably not believe me or anything. But essentially all that we are looking at is 600, 800 milligrams of ibuprofen at the earliest onset of craving or withdrawal. Okay. So, you know, the next morning you waking up, you haven't smoked. Instead of smoking, you're administering ibuprofen. Again, this should all be cleared under a doctor. I really got to say that. I mean, we are talking these high levels of ibuprofen.
Yeah. We were joking before, but seriously.
Within 15 minutes to, and again, we talked about going to the fucking doctor on dealing with addiction. Well, maybe you could go to him with this little regimen and be like, oh, dude, I want to try this and make sure he's signing off. And you can get Motrins, which I think are like 600. Actually, Motrin, even over the counter, is now 200, but usually they were like 600 milligrams, whatever. But anyway, you're looking at readministering 600, 800 milligrams of ibuprofen every typically 4 to 6 hours. You will feel the experiences of craving and withdrawal coming back in, particularly around the second, maybe even third day. You want to be aggressive with the ibuprofen. By the way, you can even talk to your doctor about this. Here's even the more experimental part of this. The psychiatrist I'm talking to this about, it actually mentioned Celebrex. Another heavy duty anti-inflammatory. I don't know about that. I've only seen this work with ibuprofen. Liquid caps are always nice. They're blue and juicy and cool. Makes you feel like you're in the fucking Matrix or whatever, you know, kind of funky.
Still got to wake up and go to work though.
The blue pill. Isn't that the motherfucker, right? That's a real addiction, man, is the work. So anyway, so here's the key. So again, we're talking, typically up to 2,400 milligrams, you're aggressively dosing with ibuprofen, keeping those doses in sort of in front of the craving, not letting the withdrawal experience build up. I've had kids come to me fucking so wide-eyed because all of a sudden, dude, they're, oh, I don't want dinner. I'm not hungry. Bam, ibuprofen administration within 15 minutes, 20 minutes. What are we eating? Wow. I couldn't sleep, all sweating, whatever. Ibuprofen before sleep. Oh shit, I feel fine. Within 3 to 5 days, total resolution. The heaviest smokers I have tried this with, and I'm talking the fucking sun up to sleep guys. No withdrawal experience at all, dude. Even the one person I recently tried it with, she kind of felt some, but it definitely took the fucking total edge off. She was able to manage through, seemed to feel real good for her. This is the first time you guys, I put this on my podcast, but spread the fucking good word around that, at least in regards to cannabis and cannabis withdrawal, that at least preliminarily, that this ibuprofen in 600, 800 milligrams, again, talking to your doctor up to 2,400, pushing the limit up to 3,000 a day. Over a period of 3 to 5 days, seems to be the absolute motherfucking cure for jonesing for weed. Now, if you want to experiment with this, even on a smaller basis, right? Again, prescription dosing on ibuprofen, talking to your doctor, blah, 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 blah. But if you wanted to, the next time somebody who's out there hearing this and doesn't have weed or doesn't have access or is traveling or doing whatever the fuck they need to do where they don't have access to pot and they do experience craving and they do experience withdrawal, dude, ask your doctor if you can pop 600 milligrams of ibuprofen and see in 20 minutes if you don't feel like fucking way better. And if you do, well, fucking email Brother Adam here and say, holy shit, it really worked. I fucking care for cannabis, because that is really the most fucking coolest thing.
Dude, that's a big deal, man. So because in states where it's still not legal, et cetera, and even places where, you know, they still test for it for your job and even legal probation. So, look, I know a lot of people use it to medicate throughout their day. You know, I find I have heard and seen even that marijuana has been good for people dealing with actual bipolar diagnosis. And so sometimes they got to come off of it. They got to pass for a job or they get, you know, some insurance tests they got to do or legal.
Yep.
So it's a big deal. And look, irritability is a big deal.
Oh,
look,
I didn't even bring up that one. Yeah. Right.
We talk about irritability so much, but those first 3 days coming off of a cannabis regimen, brother, I mean, you can end your marriage. You know,
it's funny. There's one guy I keep wanting to get on the fucking podcast. He was like heavy duty into opiates and all sorts of shit. Dude, he really struggled with fucking weed addiction. And here's what's super shitty about that. Dude, the way he was treated in fucking drug treatment as being, quote, just a marijuana addict. Dude, how do you think that made him feel? You know, he really fucking had an issue with it. I mean, in terms of just how it was affecting him. All drugs, you can hone your focus in nice and tight on some fucking drug and the world can fall away around you. And it certainly seems like for cannabis, there is a physiological withdrawal experience, not just a psychological withdrawal experience. And dude, I am so... honestly, this podcast kind of reminds me of when I first fucking talked about this on the Addictive podcast. Dude, if this actually helps somebody, man, how great will this be? If somebody out there needing sort of an option, again, you know, you do want to be careful of your fucking kidneys, all sorts of things when you're taking like any kind of medicines or whatever. But under a doctor's supervision, you would always talk to a doctor first as we're talking prescription level. But you have something that you have heard has helped profoundly. It's fucking amazing. It's the coolest thing I'm telling you, dude. I'm just in shock, and I can't wait. I'm hoping somewhere out there can even try it. However they want to use it, to give yourself an option to be on or off or whatever you want to do.
I think it's a big one, man. I'm glad we got to get that back on. Somehow the tech goblins cut it out of our last podcast, man. So
this is the most important thing, dude. It really is the most important thing. I'm telling you, I got a guy over in Dartmouth who I got his name, and he does all this kind of research, and I'll get this fucker formalized, dude. I'm telling you, there is some connection, and if anybody's out there, between this idea of inflammation and withdrawal. And we always look at sort of the inflammation response on opiates or whatever, and you know, we do rapid opioid detox or whatever, using antagonists. But dude, there's something to this connection, and there really seems to be some connection with this and cannabis. Oh, dude, another thing. Somebody just a fucking another neuroscience guy just sent me this thing that some other way that it actually inhibits the breakdown of some. Or it inhibits some enzyme, which inhibits the breakdown of some fucking thing. That's an aspect of cannabis. The other thing you'll see about ibuprofen, by the way, you won't fucking see this shit anywhere, dude. I seriously think I discovered this. The only other thing you'll see about ibuprofen and cannabis is you'll see a thing about it actually killing your buzz or killing your high or some shit like that. So there's this real relationship between anti-inflammatories and the fucking cannabinoid system, dude. There's something there. And here we see it resolving craving and withdrawal. We see it blocking effects. Very, very interesting. I only hope there's some fucking little neuroscience guy out there who can really dig into this and start helping people with it. It's very interesting.
Man, I'm glad you put it out there, because look, me being in Florida, I know a lot of, you know, daily smokers, man, that have to watch it because of, you know, work and new jobs, etc. So,
oh God, there's one thing that drug ain't worth, man. It'll fuck your life. I mean, just in terms of the consequences around it. I mean, I'm sorry that we live in prohibition, but
yeah, the legal bullshit issues, I think, are these by far the scare. Well, I think they are. I'm not going to say I think they are factually by far the riskiest issue.
I guarantee you I can introduce a nice anxiolytic condition and a nice fucking low grade depression. See how your family responds to you, dude, after you get busted for fucking weed, dude. See how that all plays out. See about your support. See about your work. See about how you're looked at. See about the money you have to spend on your fine. See how that plays out, and tell me if you don't have a little bit of a mental health issue as you're going through that. Yeah, you won't be feeling like at your peak there, dude. You're gonna need more alpha brain if that shit's going down, man. It's bad news, man. That fucking that criminal justice system. You get wrapped up in that, dude. That'll take you out. Even if the fucking drug doesn't, that shit'll take you out.
Yeah, man. And I say it almost the last three podcasts. If you haven't seen it, look up that documentary, The House I Live In.
Oh, I see. I saw it.
Dude, you know, here's a crazy left field one. I was promoting watching and telling people to watch this, the House I Live In, you know, documentary. Mm-hmm. And about the same time, my producer and manager and producer of a film that he's got coming out soon, Literature to Larceny. Everybody listening, go to literaturetolarceny.com. But anyway,
great title.
He meets a wonderful girlfriend, and I won't say her name because I think people may be able to link her to what I'm saying. But anyway, they're really hitting it off, which I'm really happy for him. And I guess she happens to be the niece of the director of that film. Of the director of The House I Live In.
Wow.
I thought, what? You know, he's the guy helping, he's the producer of not only that film, but he's also one of the executive producers of Chemical Incarceration, the documentary we're doing now.
Yeah.
And I thought, man, what are the crazy chances that I'm promoting this documentary, The House I Live In, is being, look, if you want to know about the drug war and the issues with it, watch this documentary. And he's fallen in love. Happened to be in relation to this same thing in the movie we're making. I thought, wow, time and chance.
Dude, I think that guy was at the conference. I think he was at one of the, like the plenary sessions or whatever. I think that was the director. I think he was at the conference.
No kidding. Was he a speaker at the conference?
Or received, he might've been an award recipient or just like a plenary speaker, but I think maybe an award recipient or something like that.
Yeah, Eugene. Eugene Jackery.
Could have been the dude.
J A R E C K I.
I think that was the guy. I'm not sure, but I think that was him.
Sorry for fucking up your name, dude. I apologize. Is an American author and dramatic and documentary filmmaker based in New York. His works include Why We Fight, The Trials of Henry Kissinger, Reagan, Freakonomics. Oh, he was behind Freakonomics. That was huge. I love The House I Live In. It was powerful to me.
Yeah.
So I love that documentary, man. But I thought, what are the chances, man, that the girl that my producer and manager, you know, and movie director guy happens to fall in love with? It was crazy, and nobody knew any of this. Like, he didn't know that she was related to him. I've just mentioned the movie. He talks about the movie, and then she goes, "Hey, that's my uncle."
Dude, you know, it's funny, even since I came back from the conference thing, and again, I don't know if ever, you know, who out there believes in synchronicity and shit like that. You know, like I said, I had kind of gotten into this just for doing advocacy. I never looked at it financially or whatever. But I never thought actually me risking fucking talking about drugs openly and like ending prohibition and all that shit would ever, you know, be necessarily beneficial except in my fucking heart and hopefully in families and shit like that. But dude, already the response I've gotten from some people in Department of Education, I'm supposed to go down fucking West Side School to, next week and talk to them about doing drug education. I had wanted to build up my army of students for sensible drug policy and have those guys be like a fucking, you know, march of genius, you know, just these genius community-based group and all that.
Dude, if I can help you, man, you need a speaker out there. If we can,
dude, you know, here's the thing. If you want to do anything though, to seriously, even on your own fronts over there, if you find these groups, Students for Sensible Drug Policy on any campus, connect with them, dude. I'm okay. Telling you, connect with them. If
anybody out there listening to the podcast knows anybody that's connected to, what's the name of the group?
Students for Sensible Drug Policy.
If you know anybody that's involved in that group, Students for Sensible Drug Policy, if you're at a local college or a Florida college or even Georgia, somewhere close, know somebody, email, look us up at adamlowry.com. Shoot me an email. Let me know.
Dude, they have great resources and they're just right up the fucking like that connecting point of like a lot of other groups of, and remember, dude, there's very few groups that can get the message out, right? In terms of like reform or any of that shit, right? Who's most credible? Number one, law enforcement against prohibition. They were also fucking at the conference. Fantastic group. That's all the cops talking like, hey, dude, we're tired of harming our communities and ourselves. Fuck prohibition, right? Yeah. There's that group. Super okay. credible. Yeah. You have oh, you'll like where this is going, by the way. You have the second group, Students for Sensible Drug Policy, not a bunch of fucking users, but a bunch of people passionate about wrapping up the drug war and all that shit. And they're super connected and well funded and getting it together and present very well, and they're very credible because they're high achieving college kids. Guess who wasn't at the fucking conference, Adam? So we have all those great groups, right? I mentioned almost all of them. Guess who had like no fucking representation at all. So to my horror.
Who's that?
Dude, conventional abstinence-based treatment had no, zero, nada, zilch. Representation at the fucking International Drug Policy Reform Conference.
And this is everything that is currently taught in high school, middle school. Look, I asked my daughter, I'm like, look, what do they teach you? And they're still teaching the abstinence, just say no shit.
Dude, you have...
Not that I want my daughter to use drugs, but that's not how you educate them about what they are and what they do.
Nobody was there fucking promoting drugs. Nobody at all, except maybe even the fucking hallucinogenics as a cure or the Ibogaine or ayahuasca people.
Hey, I've said it and I'm tweeting it once now every 2 weeks. I keep tweeting that I think microdosing of psychedelics of some kind can and will or should replace antidepressants by 2025.
I don't know anyone who's experienced the effects, or I've only heard about that. But dude, I mean, imagine we're in this major treatment. First of all, what kind of fucking prick here? I'm going to speak out to my fellow treatment providers out there. What kind of fucking prick bastards are you that you actually believe that your fucking client having a criminal record or going to jail or getting dirty drugs is like helpful for your patient? What kind of fucking bastard are you out there who thinks that's an okay thing? How can you fucking live at night? So the other thing about this, and you know, you look at like organizations like Hazelton or Betty Ford or these big ones, dude, you would think so imagine this, right? You have law enforcement against prohibition. You have Families for Sensible Drug Policy. This is all the families, bro. These are families that have lost their fucking children, bro. These aren't like people who are just like, yo, whatever, man, make the drugs legal. These are people who have lost their kids and see a better way and see the adulteration of drugs from prohibition and the absence of all control as a result of prohibition. When you've taken all our fucking pharmacists and our doctors and our addictionologists out of the fucking drugs and just said, here, heroin, go make that shit yourself. You know, taking all of that out. How do these fucking people live with themselves knowing that this model, which is truly the greatest lethal threat to their clients. I mean, you know, the fucking owner of the corner liquor store doesn't go shoot the other fucking owner of the corner liquor store when he's selling more Jack Daniels, man, you know? But that's the world our fucking clients live in. And not one fucking major treatment organization, dude, not even one normal, any treatment organization, abstinence only bullshit, showed up to even fucking be there, to even learn, dude. Again, nobody promoting drugs at that fucking conference at all. I'm serious, hold on, dude.
I love that. So people listening, what he's saying here, man, is these big timers of Betty Ford and Hazelton, these abstinence preaching treatment facilities, refuse to even have a presence at a place full of people that are for research and reform and education, drug policy based in empirical data and not fear and poor information.
Dude,
and they don't even show up.
I don't know how the fucking 12-step model feels about microdosing. I mean, they sure as hell feel okay about certain. No, but honestly, I mean, true. Like, look at this, dude. We're, you know, you even had like the fucking battle in there about like, you know, some people, Ibogaine's the way and total abstinence. I mean, you even have people preaching total abstinence, dude. Like people who had taken ayahuasca, people who had taken Ibogaine, the researchers who were doing the work on the, you know, fucking DMT and all this other shit, you know, they're all researching this. And, yeah, dude, apparently this model works just fine if you're in conventional drug treatment, abstinence only, What I was so fucking taken aback by, dude, is you would think they, brah, the fucking NIDA, the Marine, whatever her name is from NIDA comes there. She's the only one on the panel. We're fighting about the fucking disease model. She's there next to five people frying her ass for the disease model. Not, she's representing NIDA, you know, defending it. The fucking audience is ready to tear her head off. She is there professional and cool and thoughtful. And all I would hope would be for any abstinence organization or any abstinence-based treatment to at least be there being like, what are you guys doing? Or what do you think of this? Or,
how could we improve our recovery treatment?
Dude, like, let's look at these things, like changes happening. Like, let's at least consider, oh, nobody's representing abstinence. Well, we think abstinence is a good fucking idea. Let's go there and promote abstinence only models. And let's talk about why abstinence is the best thing for our clients. I mean, be there, be part of the fucking conversation, but where, what the fuck, bro? Not even a show up in the largest international drug policy reform conference ever. And you don't even, you know, you don't even recognize the relationship between the CARM fucking befalling your clients and
you're the big wigs on the block of addiction.
You're the leaders of this shit. By the way, those same fucking big wigs, by the way, you look at Partnership for Drug-Free Bullshit and all that, they're the same guys who are pushing on fucking doctors to kick people off of opiates. And we all know where fucking the cartels are like, come to papa. So yep. You know, no fucking cartels there. No abstinence-based treatment at the International Drug Policy Reform Conference. So, apparently they're just fine with the money's flowing, brother. I fucking hate this part. That's the one part of this whole thing that pissed me off the most, brah, is where were my people, man? So I found my super allies. I found Barry Lesson, who does his harm reduction psychotherapy group out of New York, I believe. And I found Andrew Tatarsky, who is also another fucking genius. And then I also found another guy who does harm reduction radio, Hams. He does harm reduction for alcohol. Dude, his motto, greatest motto in the world, better is better. Doesn't matter. He's like, you just don't want to get DUIs? Well, come on, we can work on that. You want to keep drinking? Come on, we can work on that. You want to work on, you know, a little bit of reduction? Come on, we can work on that. Better is better, right?
Yeah.
And so that just broke my heart, fucking not seeing anyone in conventional treatment at the whole conference, dude.
So those of you out there, for Joe Patient, who we've been discussing all night, who's been sent to your doctor, sent to a psychiatrist, told to go to rehab, and everything you see funded on your insurance is either the great, great Hazelton or Betty Ford clinics, etc. Now you see that they believe so much in their abstinent program that they won't even listen to modern day research. And who can just ignore science and research and any kind of development, especially something like addiction or mental health or development of certain disorders, man?
Dude, they seem to be fine. You know, they showed that movie, what the fuck was that called? The Business of Recovery, which was a total slam on 12 steps. And again, you know, I can't emphasize enough, dude. My purpose or the reason I was upset about it was not because I don't think fucking even conventional treatment can be helpful and abstinence only treatment can be helpful. I mean, you look at Project Match and these types of things, you know, they compare cognitive behavioral to 12 step, whatever, everything works about the same. It's ultimately coming down to, you know, you, your therapist and all the fucking work you do probably in any different form. But the fact that they are not aware or at least like teasing out the difference between addiction being harmful and the nightmare that is a client on illegal drugs from the street market. I mean, the fact that they are not even speaking to that and just sort of fine with the way things are. And again, the funding sources being sort of fine with the way things are. That's so fucking dark. Those guys, I mean, dude, why is there law enforcement against prohibition? You have the student group against prohibition, families against prohibition, and not one treatment organization. Not, dude, even myself, right? Like, there was like hardly any treatment people there, except for people like, oh, let's research psychedelics, or oh, harm reduction, or oh, needle exchange, or any of these helpful things.
If therapists show up there, brother, they could lose their fucking job. Let them show up to a place where MAPS is at. You understand? Like, they could lose their fucking job being around stuff like that because they get so sensitive, man. That's why they can't do podcasts. That's why a lot of professionals can't talk about, because they're forced into a regimen of treatment guided mainly by states and very conservative boards that are influenced by things such as big pharma, big medical, and big insurance. And this is what you get. You know, these are the offers for Joe, the patient who either becomes addicted or is in pain, etc. Your option is either pills or more pills, or commit yourself to something, when you and I both know what you're doing now for those kids. And what I believe and what I'm now starting to do and what we offer is that type of treatment, where we're going into the home with a team and we're fixing the entire thing. And I'm modeling it behind my book, The Cognitive Rampage Approach, which was, you know, TSBT. And where it's all phases. It's environmental, it's cognitive, it's behavioral, it's routine. Yep. It's changing, but also going deep into the psychology of it all and really rooting that out. So that's what we're starting to do now, privately. And so I think what you're doing, I don't know, I want to kind of join this fight of changing the, you know, standard practice of treatment. Yes, I'm glad there is something, okay? I don't want to fight to take away the something. I want to fight to add the more of something, the better working of something.
Dude, it was funny. That was the one thing I actually came out of the conference with. It's kind of depressing, but dude, I'll tell you this, like, this is one sort of overall experience I got. This fucking drug war, dude, it ain't ending. If you even think you're out there and you're like, marijuana legalization, well, dude, there's like those little changes taking place, but this fucking drug war, dude, like, they even found out, like, or it seems to be like, even when you sort of like, oh, we can't fuck with you for cigarettes, well, then like, they sort of fuck with you more for open containers. Always seems to be some sort of funky invasive thing there.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, that's why, dude, I came out of this conference not actually wanting to fight the fucking power in the drug war. Dude, I came out wanting to get into primary prevention, right? You know,
Angle, brother. You may be convincing me. Keep selling me.
Dude, okay. So the idea being is I want to have normal, dude, I want to have conversations like we're having right now happening all over the fucking world, right? And so I think that the future of that conversation comes out of my little Students for Sensible Drug Policy people, dude. They're on campus. They're not.
What are we calling for here then? Look, it's because we all know that I'm out fighting the AKA war on drugs, right? And that's a generalist term. Yeah. And I've been contemplating chasing certain policy changes that have more to do with standardized treatment. And if that's really the angle here, I'm listening. And so the student group, what are they calling for? Is it just education? Or are they actually providing solutions to treat?
Different chapters offer different things, right? So for example, what I want to develop is I want to develop their ability to actually be able to be effective in secondary schools, right? So I want to have a bunch of University of Hawaii and a bunch of Hawaii Pacific University genius kids who know about fucking drugs, and or have normal, or I should say experimental patterns of use that are regulated or whatever, just fucking normal people, man. I want to put normal people in front of other normal people, like families and kids, and have a conversation about drugs. Talk about, you know, what addiction is. Talk about how people resolve those things. Talk about how most people resolve on their own. Talk about how addiction doesn't have to be the fucking lifelong sentence that, you know, most people sort of manage these things as biopsychosocial conditions are affecting them and they kind of come in and out of it. Just have a conversation. So I feel like if we can get some of these groups like SSDP having a conversation in the schools, in the community, that we can start making change. And again, the old model, dude, think about it. The old model of education is sort of this top down. Here's the expert. You know, you go to this, you know, here come the experts. They come in and they train you. Well, I think the new model is more internet styled, right? It's more loose. It's more, you know, sort of the guy at home doing a lot of research. Even you have these students who are fucking well-versed in drug policy. They're not expert trainers in drug policy, but they sure as heck fucking know about the drug war. And they sure as heck know a lot about drugs. And most of them know a lot more about drugs than fucking I do. I mean, look at the guy I have, my little drug expert, a young guy, millennial. Yeah. He knows more about that shit than I'll ever fucking know about drugs. So
what's his name? What's his name again?
Seth Fitzgerald, dude. He does.
Yeah, guys, check out Check out his podcast, yeah, man. Check out Glenn's podcast.
Well, any drug do you want to fucking know about? He does the drug classroom on YouTube, and he's real fucking popular with that. But so having this student body, dude, that can rise up and start having the conversation. It's, you know, think about it. It's always been, you know, marijuana activist, woohoo, fucking normal, you know, legalized weed, whatever. Right. And for all the right reasons or whatever. Yeah, and all these groups, but now to have a professional student organization in the same way you have a professional law enforcement organization, like Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, those guys having this conversation, that's why it also drives me fucking crazy that, like, American Society for Addiction Medicine, I didn't see them having a presence at this fucking conference either. NIDA shows up, dude. NIDA's the bomb. NIDA came. They took it on the chin for disease model concept. They were in the conversation. They were there fucking kicking ass. They're doing the best they could. You know, where are these? It's badass, dude. Go NIDA, right? But where's ASAM? You know, with your biopsychosocial spiritual disease model of addiction, I use your fucking criteria. Show the fuck up, you know.
I'm waiting on you to go. And this has been Glenn Marshall reporting live from the Drug Policy Alliance.
Conference. Oh well, dude, these guys. Again, any cause you have, whether it be anything, any kind of fucking passionate thing that you, when you can get this was critical, by the way, in my development in this advocacy thing, dude. Right. So from going to, hey, I'm going to pick up my shitty Bluetooth and start talking to it about fucking drugs to go into this conference, to being in front of my fucking senator, man, the fucking senator was so great. Oh God, what was the most amazing moment. That took that conference, that took getting all the great ideas you have about drug policy don't mean, or they don't go really very far at all. But you put that in a pool of other people who are doing shit and thinking about these things and making moves based on these decisions. Suddenly you're part of like this pretty badass group, man, of people who are, and dude, being part of this again, like Families for Sensible Drug Policy and things like that. This group of these families that have struggled and just want good information and see the drug war as hurting their families. Bro, let me say one more thing. This amazing person at this conference, one of the women there was a mother who had lost a child to MDMA overdose. The kid took like five times as much MDMA and the girl died. Just fucking tragic. The mother's there. The mother reconciles with the person, the dealer that sells her the drugs, right? The mother is against prohibition because of how the drugs weren't regulated, that her daughter didn't know what she took. It was so fucking meaningful. I forget my bigger point on that, but oh, so even the idea of having these families that are, you know, have even lost children to drugs and are against prohibition. I mean, that is such a credible voice. And
I'll be interested there, to hear Kelly, may say it wrong. Kelly Crevasse, is going to come on. She lost her son to, drugs.
Oh yeah.
She's going to come on, I think probably towards the end of the month. I want to hear her stance, you know, on whether she sees prohibition, because that regulation is a big deal.
Yeah. Well, even someone like that, I mean, I would steer her towards this Family for Sensible Drug Policy. Again, this wonderful psychotherapist is part of this group. He invited me in for one of their little community sessions. Dude, I explained multisystemic therapy, intensive home-based therapy. I got like a fucking, you know, a high five all around, like, oh my God, where has this been? And why is this not implemented? And how do we find this? And I'm like, oh, geez, dude.
So sad. Yeah, dude. Well, thank you for reporting from the Alliance, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, again, dude, I hope putting some of these organizations out there that, dude, they're all out there and they're waiting to hear from you. You want to be into safe drug testing at parties and shit, dude, hook up with fucking DanSafe. You're going to college and you want to suddenly have start having an active voice in terms of, even discussing differences or things being differently, hook up with Students for Sensible Drug Policy. You're a parent and you want to look at drugs through a different lens. Maybe you're being directly affected now. Hook up with Family for Sensible Drug Policy. You want to just do advocacy and be into that, hook up with Drug Policy Alliance. You want to address your alcohol and you don't know where to turn with that, hook up with HAMS or Harm Reduction for Alcohol, H-A-M-S. You want to, who else is there? You want to talk about getting into the fucking needle exchange, dude. They're looking at, you know, clean injection site things. You want to get
psychedelic research,
dude. Yeah. They had the marijuana people there. They were fucking, trying to do their thing, dude. They had the Cato Institute there. They had, just all these different groups. You're into psychedelics. You have good knowledge about psychedelics, dude. You should have seen, fucking Rick Doblin, dude, the head of MAPS, walking with my boy Seth Fitzgerald, right? Well, oh, it was like the fucking, cause dude, one of my like things here is I love like building him up. Cause dude, you build up people around you and it that feels really good to do when you're fucking doing advocacy. So dude, you had like the guy for like psychedelic studies. And like, I think Seth even hit him with like a Tizolam or some drug. And he's like, even Rick fucking Doblin, Mr. like MAPS, was like, I didn't hear that one before. And dude, again, those moments, right, where you're seeing like you know, young guy, genius Seth, walking with old school, like hardened, strong driver of, you know, psychedelic research, Rick Doblin, you know, it meant so much to him. That's what these conferences can produce. So, yeah, there's a group out there that you can move the discussion forward with. You don't have to feel so isolated. That was the most important thing that came out of that conference for me. And go see your fucking senator.
Hey, and look up the Addictive Podcast and Glenn Marshall on iTunes, fuckers.
Yeah, man.
It's awesome. It's worth it. I love it, dude.
It's crazy. We do these long and in-depth, you know, the drug conversations. I want to find... I want to get more even into treatment and just talking to treatment people. I want to talk to abstinence people. I want to talk to 12-step. I just want to get all the voices of addiction heard, both sides of the thing. Let's open up the discussion. Because, dude, once the truth and the discussion and sort of the facts and things start, or even the debate, you know, is happening, at least we're talking about it. And that's the one thing about prohibition, dude, is it leaves you nowhere to go. By the way, I should also say, look up, if you're into drug education, look up the Safety First program, Drug Policy Alliance. That's Safety First, or the Upfront program now out of Colorado or California. That's another thing, dude. These fucking mindful, sensible, you know, post-prohibitionary drug education programs are starting to emerge now about like, dude, oh, the greatest motto. Instead of just say no, N-O, just say K-N-O-W, just say no.
Ah, I got it. I got it.
Bringing it, right? Stop the Harm, another big program, the internet. Oh, dude, just there's a lot of people out there, and connect with them and move forward for whatever your issue is. That made a huge difference for me. So I'm happy to be a part of it.
Dude, I can see it on you, man. That lit a cognitive rampage under your ass tonight.
Well, where's my treatment voice, man? Dude, here we go. Ready? This is the official fucking first moment of what are we? Treatment providers, the TP for sensible drug policy. I mean, Adam, there's nobody.
We're the toilet paper for
toilet paper for sensible drug policy, dude. But I mean, there was nobody from treatment, and I'm so like, where are my people? And I'm like looking around for them, like lost puppy. I'm like, where's treatment? Oh, do you know any treatment people? Like, I'm seriously like walking around, like kind of, and of course running into the guys who do that again. The two guys who were there who were like big with that. But dude, there was no treatment.
Well, I think, as it tells me, the majority of treatment workers are working within a 12-step abstinence-based treatment approach in this country. And if they step out and support or promote something else, especially something MAPS or something is at, they can lose their job, bro. So they can't even. And here's the other thing. I'm going to even go beyond losing their job. They would lose their own dignity because they know they can't show up there and support something, although they may believe in and may want to support. They can't utilize in their own practice or because of their own licensing boards. They're held within some conservative bullshit, old fashioned construct research, and they can't even speak out. So they can't even support it. So you know what? I think most of the treatment people, you know why they're not there? It's because they still have an ounce of dignity left that they know they can't be a hypocrite and show up at that thing, really supporting it, and then go back Monday and start preaching about, well, just withstand.
Well, dude, I would at least want them there than telling everybody how abstinence is the path and we need fucking dude. But you
they
had
can't, they can't
you
had, because they agree with you. See, they don't really believe in abstinence, but they have to do it to keep their job.
You literally had Republicans for drug policy reform had a booth at the fucking conference, dude. Okay. Republicans for drug policy, whatever. They're there like, look, you know, and they're there like William Buckley and, you know, all these super, you know, hardcore conservatives have always, dude, it's the ultimate conservative issue. You got to be a fucking federalist liberal wimp to think that the government should be so up your ass and in your body that we need to regulate all drugs. That's totally a fucking liberal fuck position. I mean, it really is. But yet the Republicans sort of adopt that. But yeah, you even had the Republicans for like drug policy reform at this thing. So dude, even if you're like all about abstinence and all about treatment, then at least be part of the conversation. So, and by the yeah, and that Ibogaine, by the way, is showing apparently some pretty fucking seriously badass outcomes. Now I got the guy who is like the director of all this shit. I'm interviewing him out of fucking Mexico. I can picture it. I'm going to turn it on. There's going to be like a Corona. I'm so stereotypical, right? He's going to have like ocean waves in the background. And no, but I just picture, I mean, he's like, I think he's running a bunch of these centers. I can't wait to talk to him. And again, dude, if you're in a conventional abstinence treatment, at least be speaking to that. You know, at least bring that to the table in a major policy discussion. Even if you're like, yeah, we need prohibition to keep fucking everybody up, we'll defend that. Defend that why you need that and why that's best for our patients. I'll listen. I want to understand, dude. I want to hear. I didn't like being in a fucking echo chamber either in that place where everyone just like, this is the way. You know, I wanted abstinence people there. I wanted to hear that position. I wanted to hear the discussion between them and the other folks and whatever. And I couldn't get it because, you know, they're still too fucking in their own world to do that.
Well, that's what I was saying. I think that the part is, I agree with you that the giant abstinence people believe it should have been there. But I mean the actual practitioners that are,
yeah.
I think they're forced to practice it even though they don't believe in it. So yeah. That's why I was trying to say they didn't come to the conference because they really agree with us. But they know that they can't come talk shit about it, knowing they have to go back to work on Monday, held within confines. You know what I mean?
Well, dude, think of the changes taking place now, right? And this is one of the reasons why I wanted to do primary prevention over here is because so we have the fucking weed dispensaries coming in like in June. Right. That's the new plan. There's going to be weed dispensaries here. So I want to have the new conversation. As that happens, and look at me, dude, I'm all here being like, marijuana is addictive. Like, I'm not the fucking guy to be like, weed is no problem, whatever. I want to be having that conversation about cannabis as the fucking dispensaries, are coming in here. You know what I'm saying? And looking at the addictive aspects of that. In that conversation, you know, there's places now where we're in DC, right? In Washington, in Oregon, in Colorado. Well, what does an abstinence-based drug treatment person say to a person who's smoking weed? What does 12-step say to a person who's smoking cigarettes and drinking caffeine? You know, what is the conversation when a person is on methadone? What do you say? Do you still try to hold to those rigid structures of you're clean and, oh, but you're not because, oh, you're clean because you're on fucking, Abilify, but you're not because you're on, methadone or whatever the fuck or Suboxone or whatever. Are we going to keep holding on to that or is it time for like a new conversation? I mean, change is happening, dude. Medication assisted therapy is now being pushed by ONDCP. Thank God. And again, I know your feelings on all that, but better that than death. Fucking A.
I would agree. I'm good with that one, death for sure.
So dude, you would think those guys, I mean, if you're fucking Hazelton or Betty Ford, wouldn't you want to be on the cutting edge of like Ibogaine research or like ayahuasca or any like, dude, you mean I can give someone fucking psychedelics or you mean our patients who come in here on opiates could go out smoking weed and they're, they're going to be actually inhibited from or from relapse onto methamphetamine or opiates. Yes. Well, fuck, bro. Yo, Hazelton, you don't want to hear that? Like, that's not a little pertinent to you? I mean, maybe the next time one of your fucking clients is out there and he's like, yeah, I'm not using opiates, but I'm smoking weed every day. Maybe you don't rob his goddamn chip. Maybe you fucking give him a pat on the back and say, hey, the great that you found what works in your life.
Because I mean, maybe better is better.
Yeah, better. Oh, you're gonna steal my boys. Yeah, that's the dude. That guy was the coolest, man. He does a podcast, by the way, Harm Reduction Radio.
Oh yeah, what's his name? Put him out there for again. Oh,
I don't know his name, but HAMS. Yeah, HAMS Harm Reduction Radio. I forget his name. But dude, that's his motto. Better is better. And he's just all about the essence of harm reduction for alcohol. His podcast was actually part of the fucking inspiration for me
It's Kenneth Anderson.
Kenneth Anderson is like running his own little world for people on alcohol who want to do anything to improve their lives. And he's the fucking guy. He's the booze guy, man.
The booze guy. I like that, man.
Reduction, man. I mean, better is better.
I'm going to get this dude on the podcast, man.
Oh, dude, he's amazing. He's listen to his podcast. He's a fucking dude. He is an encyclopedia of drug history, of addiction history, of treatment history. Oh man, yeah, he is. He called NIDA out as NIDA's like, yeah, we're now trying to define more use versus abuse, and he calls him out. He's like, well, as of this time on your website, you did not delineate between use and abuse. It's like fucking right on it. Kenneth is a hero, man. He's one of the all those guys were, dude. You got to realize, man, these are people who are there's not many of them out there. They're doing psychotherapy and harm reduction. They're doing harm reduction with alcohol. These are guys like Stanton motherfucking Peel was, you don't know who that is, but he's like my super idol. I mean, he was like,
yeah, we talked about him on the first podcast, man.
On the panels, he was there shaking. I was like wanting to give him the biggest hug. He's getting into fights with people about addiction being a disease and all that shit. But dude, him and Ethan Nadelman, it was a fucking drug policy reformer's wet dream, man.
Thanks for like, I don't need to go. No, I think I'm going to go next year, man. Thanks for bringing all that info, man, too, and shouting out all those people.
Yeah,
and
every 2 years. Next time is in Georgia, dude. Here's the thing, dude. I'm telling you, if you want to take a step, see if you can find one of those SSDP chapters near you. Go even meet them or talk to them. See what they're doing. Don't be surprised if they don't want to like pick your brain. And I just find those guys, to be a wealth of information and
one more time, what are they again?
Students for Sensible Drug Policy.
Students for Sensible.
Yeah, they're like, I'm not sure. Yeah, they got some real power, dude.
Yeah, I got them pulled up here. Yeah, I got a couple people to search, man. Every time I talk to you, I got more interesting people too.
Oh, dude, this is so great, man. I mean, Adam, I tell you, in all of advocacy, the best feeling is other people sort of raising up that I get the fucking serious like fucking ear to ear smile on that, dude, with other people, like someone out there being like, oh, I'm going to check out SSDP, or I'm going to, oh, family, oh, or I'm a parent and I want to learn more about, you know, rational response to this. I'll go check out Families for Sensible Drug Policy, or, oh, I need treatment. I'll check out, you know, Center for Optimal Living or Barry Lesson or one of these guys. Dude, this is all, they're all out there, and it would have never happened without fucking DPA, Drug Policy Alliance, rallying everyone together. But there's just a few of them, but dude, it's being in that world, you'd think it was cutting edge out there, dude, you know, psychedelic research. And
I think it's awesome, man. And
dude, they're going to phase 3, by the way, on that shit. Like, don't be surprised if you don't see MDMA like legal for like therapeutic purposes in like 10 years. I'm not kidding, dude.
Remember I said 2025 microdosing of psychedelics, dude, for antidepressants.
I should say with MDMA re-legalized, right? That was a legal substance and pulled out. Yeah. But yeah, all that shit is, yeah, dude, it makes you almost feel like a normal person being there.
Dude, thanks again, brother, man. And
my pleasure.
So everybody look him up too, man. Glenn Marshall, the Addictive Podcast, my boy. Thanks.
Yeah, it's going good. And Yeah, beyond that shit, I want to find treatment. I got these good people coming on, but I want to maybe even more stories of recovery. Just all the voices. Here's what I'm looking for, dude. If you've been functional like amphetamine user or maybe even not functional, but you have like, I want good harm reduction information. Like I want someone to tell me more about like how to manage any of these drugs or how people can do that more safely or how to navigate anything or funny. I just fucking anything. I just love getting the information out there. So yeah, hook me up info@theaddictivepodcast.com.
Cool, dog.
Or Twitter, dude. Twitter. Get me on Twitter. ADDICTIST. That's the fucking bro. Twitter, all this shit started. I don't even do social media, but now I fucking like the Twitter. So tweet me.
Look him up, man, and hold it down out in Hawaii, man. I got to set up a trip next year, probably in July, where I'm coming out to Alaska to see my brother. I got to go out to L.A., Northern California, a friend in Oregon, and now I got to go see my buddy Glenn out on the islands, man.
Oh, that would be the shit, dude. It's great out here. I still tell you, dude, the Bahamas is still better. I know all the Hawaii people, fucking, they love it over here, but, dude, the out islands of the Bahamas, Exuma's, Eleuthera, man, fuck, I'll take that shit any day.
Oh, I'm with you, man, but I won't pass up a trip coming out to Hawaii.
No, it's not too shabby. Yeah, right on, brother. Well, hopefully I got something to show you in regard to some pretty cool educational reforms we're chewing on. I'm moving around the pieces of the chessboard now, so yeah, might be some good stuff to show you.
Yeah, man. Well, I'll shoot you an email after this anyway, because you sparked some stuff I'm going to be thinking, man. I'm going to be having a rather interesting meeting tomorrow, but it may include a lot of shit we talked about here. But
I like your sober fucking coaching kind of marching in there, kind of redesigning all that shit. I love talking about that aspect of therapy, dude. I'd be happy to talk to you more about that. Yeah, that's a great model, man. You got to get in people's lives. And if you can engage and be in their lives and work on the restructuring and all that shit, dude, you know, sober coach, congratulations. There's the fucking title, dude.
Yeah, whatever that, it is. It's get people right, man, because, you know, it doesn't even have to be addiction either, man, because you can be going through depression. You lost somebody, divorce. I mean, and still you bring in that same, you know, psychosocial dynamic full on from nutrition approach, everything. And you fix it all.
Dude, doing cardiovascular exercise, doing some fucking weights, doing those kale shakes, dude. I got out of the ocean after swimming about a mile, dude. You know, you could pretty much shove a fucking spear through me and I'll be like, oh, you know, I could deal with that or whatever.
Yeah, honestly. We bring one of my other guests, Julian Williams, who's a professional MMA fighter. He's got a fight coming up in a couple months, but he's our physical training person. He's the guy who comes into the life and starts to teach you that. Yeah.
Well, jiu-jitsu too, dude. You know, that was going to be my replacement for swimming on the mainland. Yeah, BJJ, man. Oh, that dude, that's another highly preventative. You don't want to be addicted to shit. Dude, jiu-jitsu will fuck up your whole addiction, dude. Like you will be in there, you will be sweating, you'll be getting choked out. You want to be focused and you'll feel like this group of people around you that like instantly loves you to death. And that's a real jiu-jitsu will fuck up your addiction any day also. So try BJJ for sure.
All right, brother. I really got to go this time, man.
I know. I'm keeping you on. Right on, Adam. Well, my pleasure and always good to talk with you, man. Thank you, and keep up the good fight.
I love chatting with you, dude.
Right on. Aloha.
I love chatting with my boy, Glenn. It's always a good time, always educational for me. I hope you enjoyed it. You'll probably see Glenn on a lot going into 2016. Speaking of which, will be a big year for The Cognitive Rampage, myself. The book, The Cognitive Rampage, A Dose of Authentic Revelation, will be coming out mid-January, and we will be hitting the road. My manager and producer, Daniel McNamara, being the podcast, a mobile podcast in an RV from Orlando or from St. Pete, Tampa, Florida, actually, or St. Pete area, St. Pete Beach, Florida, to New York City. We will probably spend about a week on the trip there.
But I'll keep you up to date more on when the book will release. So I hope you enjoyed it and hope you're taking care of you.